You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass!
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
This man's got hands!
Make love in the hammock!
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 135 for the 11th of June, 2011. I am David McVeigh, and I am joined in studio by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
Hello.
We are also joined by returning guest Katrina Smith. Long time no see, Katrina.
Hello. Glad to be here.
All right, so proper introductions are in order. What do we say? We say actress, writer, comic, singer, stand-up comedian. What else? Anything else? Medical fuss budget, Katrina Smith. And she has joined us here today for a review of J.J. Abrams' latest film, Super 8.
Why don't I get one of those?
Because you've been here too long. I did that the first time you came on, remember? We also are going to cover a little bit of film news, which includes a few trailers, brand new list of five, this time five great films for the Super 8 era. And we'll explain what that means a little bit later in the show. But first, feedback. We have one feedback today. Feedback is from Kat. She says, "Hey, guys, gang, peeps, and such. I just listened to the start of the Film Actually podcast as I only caught part of the later stuff live on Saturday. I went to see X-Men First Class here in Canberra with hubby and friends in the premium lounge. No idea if that would make a difference. We are most certainly certain we saw the version with the longer special effects scenes. What shocked us was that there was no extra at the end of the credits, especially as there is a new Marvel movie coming out, and I figured they would want to plug it. We were wondering if there was a difference in that between versions as well. Thanks for another great show, HC Widget, who's in our chat room. Now, HC Widget, I actually sent you an email about this, so you've probably got your answer already, but I thought we'd bring this up on the show. Just to clarify that there is a difference between Marvel-produced films and Marvel-licensed films. The films that have the tag at the end are generally the Marvel-produced films. These are the films that are produced by Marvel Pictures and distributed at the moment by Paramount and soon to be Disney for next year for the Avengers will be Disney. The other films are actually licensed films. They've actually licensed the Marvel character, and even though it says the Marvel logo at the beginning, they are co-produced by Marvel, but they're not within the same world. X-Men and Fantastic Four and one other that is gone out of my head right now are 20th Century Fox films. Spider-Man, Ghost Rider are Sony films. so they're not within... Blade is a Roadshow, Warner Brothers co-production, so that's actually on their side.
So is that why all the Iron Man ones have the teaser at the end?
That's right, because two Iron Man films, The Incredible Hulk, not the first one, though. The first Hulk, the Ang Lee one, was a licensed film through Universal. They lost the license. Obviously, they didn't want to continue on because the film was a disaster. Marvel bought it back, and then they produced The Incredible Hulk. The Incredible Hulk is part of the canon, but not the first Hulk. So that's why they kind of rebooted the whole thing. Thor is one of the Marvel-produced films, and the next one out of the gate will be Captain America, and then the Avengers next year. Excuse me, I had a piece of chocolate bar stuck in my throat before the show. So I'm
when
still...
candy attacks.
No, thank you.
No?
No, thank you. I don't think I need to put anything else in my mouth at this point in time. Bazinga. Anyway, so that hopefully explains that a little bit. So you got to be careful what is Marvel produced and what is Marvel licensed. And I'm sure Marvel would love to have all the licenses back for all of their stuff so they can make one mighty universe. But it's unfortunately not the way it works. There was talk that they were really pushing hard to get the next Ghost Rider film, which is coming out next year, by the directors of the Crank films.
Now, importantly, will that have Nicolas Cage and will it have his strange hair?
Yes and yes.
Does the hair get its own credit?
Probably.
Right.
I think we could just sum that up with the quote about William Shatner. I remember hearing an interview on the radio back in the late 90s, early 2000s from Michael Dorn, who played Worf on TNG. The radio announcer here in Australia, who basically said, "So, okay, one last question, Mr. Worf, is that William Shatner's hair or not?" And Worf's and Michael Dorn's answer was perfect, where he said, "Of course, it's his hair. He paid for it. It's his."
Michael Dorn.
I just thought that was a wonderful answer to a stupid question. All right, so let's move on. So hopefully that explains that just a little bit. We normally do a what we've been watching section at this point, but I think we're going to forego this because I have a feeling...
For starters, there's three of us.
There's three of us, and I have a feeling that our lists of five and our review are probably going to go long. So
I have cocked up my list of five.
No, and there's no such thing as cocking up those lists.
We I think I've given it a red hot go.
All right, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. So let's move on to our feature review at this point.
And I'm actually hoping I can remember my review because I just remember I wrote it into the computer, which is over there currently off. So I don't know what I'm going to do.
You've got a brain size of a planet.
I'm sure you can figure it out.
I'll make it up.
I think we pretty much got the same list anyway, probably. So.
Oh, no. Trust me. I went out of my way to pick titles that I don't think you'll have on your list.
Oh, okay. That's very interesting. We'll get to that in the end. Let's do a feature film review because I'm very excited about this. This week, we are going to review the film Super 8, written and directed by J.J. Abrams. It stars Joel Courtney. Now, if you'll notice the credits list here, I put the kids first because as far as I'm concerned, the adult actors are secondary to these kids. So Joel Courtney, Elle Fanning, Ryan Lee, Zach Mills, Riley Griffiths, and Gabriel Basso make up the kids, and the adults are made up by Ron Eldard and Noah Emmerich, but who cares about them? Actually, not quite fair, because they actually weren't not too bad. In the summer of 1979, a group of friends in a small Ohio town witness a catastrophic train crash while making a Super 8 movie and soon suspect that it was not an accident. Shortly after, unusual disappearances and inexplicable events begin to take place in town, and the local deputy tries to uncover the truth, something more terrifying than any of them could have imagined. And the source of this comes from the official Super 8 site. So this is the way they're promoting it. We do have a trailer. Let's watch this trailer, and then we will come back and talk about it.
I've got nothing against your friends. I like your friends. Well, things have obviously changed for us.
I have to help Charles finish his movie.
Be good for you to spend some time with kids who don't run around with cameras and monster makeup.
Could you close your eyes, please?
Yeah. Guns, watch out!
An eastbound freighter derailed. What the cargo was on that freighter, we don't know.
We can't tell anyone.
I know.
I understand you have concerns about our cargo.
Colonel, there isn't anything else that I should know, is there?
I can assure you the answer is no.
We've gotten calls from people who have found local dogs, but the calls coming in aren't local.
Lucy!
It's like they all just ran away.
I've got property damage. I've got theft. I've got 9 people missing now. There are things happening around here that I can't explain.
Feel good about this.
Go!
I saw it. No one believes me.
I believe you.
What the hell?
Okay, that's super. Boy, that cut off abruptly, didn't it? Our chat room, before we go any further, Callicent has wanted to make mention of that when I was rattling off the 20th Century Fox licenses for Marvel, Daredevil was the one I couldn't remember. So yeah. Daredevil is also a licensed one. Daredevil was the one I was thinking of. They have had to rush a new Daredevil film into production because they're about to lose the license. And all I can say is, please, just delay a little bit longer and give Daredevil back to Marvel.
Who's going to be Daredevil?
They're actually in talks at the moment, but you know the in Twilight... there was talk at one point of Robert Pattinson, but that seems to have dropped by the wayside. But you know the crazy guy who in the first Twilight was fresh and still wanted to eat people?
Yeah.
And then by the end of it, he was like the hero's general who was leading all the vampires into battle. They're talking about him as Daredevil at this point. So I can't remember his name. That's why I'm doing the Twilight references. I'm sure somebody in the chat room can help me out. All right.
I'm sure he's done other things.
And too. I'm sure he's done other things. Actually, he did say something I saw not long ago, and he was actually really bad in it. But anyway. Okay. Who wants to start us off here?
Not me.
Oh, Katrina's bowed out. Josh, would you like to start us off here?
Yeah, okay, cool.
Okay, cool.
as I was explaining to Dave, this is about the fourth thing I have written on this. Fifth thing that I have organized over Super 8. So,
I was going to say, we're... Just to interrupt you for a second, Josh, I'll let you finish. But just to finish off, Josh and I have been living with this film now for 2 weeks.
Which, by the way, the Paramount, we have
problem at all. But we've had embargoes. We haven't been able to talk about it. And we've seen advanced clips of it. Then we got to see preview screenings of it. Then we've actually sat down and talked to J.J. Abrams. It's been a long gestation period to get to here. Mm. So now we're finally here.
That was like all I was going to say. So, all right. Well, look, film-wise, look, you and me are both a huge fan of kind of this era of film that they are homaging in this, you know, sort of rebirth. And I've talked at length about the fact that I think that for me, one of the main components that's been missing out of blockbusters for years has been heart. Mm. And just the fact that heart is just this component that without it, a film can be a summer blockbuster and then disappear. But if you nail that style of filmmaking, if you get that heart right, then you'll find that it will speak to you and it will stay in people's minds. And it's like, you know, these films will always have people that like them and don't like them, and that's fine. But over time, you always find that a film that can do that well will always stand the test of time and be in people's DVD collections, you know, 10, 15 years from now. And I got that in spades. I got a really nice story. I thought the kids, especially Elle Fanning and Joel Courtney, were fantastic. Like, it was just so nice to not feel pandered to as an audience member. Like, kids that swear, things that are discussed that kids actually discuss when you're that age group, you know, sort of excessive use of swear words, because at that stage it's all new and fresh to you, and you can say it around your friends.
Hang around a schoolyard for a while, exactly. You'll hear these words, you know?
Exactly, and it's like, it's nice to kind of go back and sort of follow a story that just follows these people stuck in amongst something a lot bigger than themselves. And look, I love the film. I absolutely adore the cast. I think every one of the kids did a great job. That scene that we'll see, again, no spoilers, I know. The scene just before the train actually crashes, in my opinion, is the stellar scene of the entire film.
Yeah.
And it really kind of, it's got heart, it's cute, it's funny, but then also leads into that amazing train wreck.
Really frustrating, actually, because Paramount actually made an extended version of that clip available online, a six-minute clip, which was that scene. We put it up on the site, and by that afternoon, they pulled the clip. And so this wasn't like a YouTube, like somebody pulled. Paramount pulled their own clip, and it's like, I'm still trying to get to the bottom of where can I get this clip again, and why did they pull it off their own thing, you know?
Wow, that's really odd.
Yeah, it is. It's very strange. So you'd think if you're pulling their official stuff from their official channel that you'd be able to use it, but then, I mean, I got an email saying, do you want this extended clip available? So it's like, it was, I don't know what happened. I have very strange. Still haven't.
My feeling is someone from Paramount got the sack. You put that up?
Yeah, I have a feeling J.J. Abrams said,
you gave away the best scene?
We are sacking you and taking your kidneys.
All right.
Sounds like something Paramount would do.
Yeah, it does. Like.
No, we love you guys.
Love you, Paramount.
Anyway.
Love you, Misha.
Well.
All right, so I'm going to assume that you like this film.
That I said that.
I know. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
I loved the film. I really did.
You just said it in a very understated way. I was kind of like,
Everything I say is understated. Good. I'm the king of understated. Anyway,
except when you hate something, let's talk about Duke here.
All right. Well, look, I really enjoyed the film. Look, does it stand up and, you know, sort of fit in amongst, you know, things like E.T.? You know, like, probably not quite that good, but it's a damn good film. It's funny. It's got plenty of action. It's intriguing because it doesn't give everything away, so you don't just know what's going on. You kind of get bits and bobs as you go along through the movie. I think probably if we broke it into four bits, I would say the third one was the one where I got a little disorientated because a lot of the war things that start happening and stuff like this just seem a little over the top. But that would be about my only gripe in the film. Other than that, I just absolutely adore this film, and I think everybody should go see it. Because if no other reason, it's nice to have a film that you could take a kid to and get the same experience for you and them. Because they're going to relate, and you are going to remember. So it's that great kind of thing. And you took your son, and he absolutely loved this film.
Yeah, that's kind of a heat. And now, just to remind everybody, that if you stick around after the audio listeners, if you stick around after the end credits, Little Geek is going to give his opinions on this film as well. So we'll get the perspective of somebody who is in the age group that, if I was a child, when this film is set, and this is the thing that really got me about this film, 1979... These kids are 12, 13 years old. When I was in 1979, I was 12, 13 years old. This is my life. Right? There's a scene where I went into, I was telling Josh afterwards, where they go to Charles's house, and there's the chaos of Charles's house with the kid bashing things on the table and the mother trying to get them all breakfast. And all I could think is, that was my household. That is exactly what the Deutsch household, with all my uncles and aunts and everybody, because we had a huge family living in this house, and it was always chaos like that at all times. When I looked at the group of friends, J.J. Abrams managed to completely and utterly nail every member. Those five kids, those five boys, are myself and four of my friends. And I could see quite clearly each one of my friends in each one of those kids. I was Charles the filmmaker. I had a friend who was a hypochondriac. You know, it's like, and so you can actually see all of these boys in my, I'm sitting there going, Jesus, this is so me. You know, this is so, and I grew up in a neighborhood, and I could, the whole idea of the tract housing and the E.T. style housing complexes where all the houses look the same. I remember that from the 70s. I was in America in 79, you know? And so you sit there and you look at it and go, wow, it's just remarkably captures that era, that style so well.
Well, it's something he said in the interview where he was actually saying, I didn't want this to feel like the greatest hits of the 70s.
That's right.
He was like, I didn't want this to feel like the greatest hit of 79. I just wanted it to feel natural. And he said that the whole thing about it that works is the fact that it doesn't have that kind of like, what was the top five songs of 79? Slap, 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 slap. You know, just
no,
so that
it's
you can
a little
build.
Slice. It's what my sister calls an interval.
Yeah.
And it's just that interval at that time, like that summer, that's what they're focusing on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not saying, as you say, suddenly 79's highlighted and all the hits.
Well, and J.J. Abrams said, because one of the questions I asked, and what we were alluding to here is we got to sit down with J.J. Abrams for a 20-minute round table
discussion. Which is
available
on the website. You should go check it out.
I was about to do. Very nice plug. Thank you. I was about to say, it's on the
seamless.
It's on the Film Actually feed as well. So if you just down, if you subscribe to the podcast, you've probably already got it. And if you don't subscribe to the podcast and you only listen, you can, as Josh said, you can find it at geekactually.com. Just look for J.J. Abrams Roundtable. You'll find it. But he actually, one of the questions we asked was, what did you have to nail to get the period? Because it's not perfect. The period detail is not perfect.
No.
And some of the hairdos may not be perfect. Some of the clothing may not be perfect. But it felt like 79. And so he really did nail the feeling of that era. And so the question, of course, was, what did you feel you had to get to make that? And he said he wanted to catch the era from the inside out rather than the outside in. So he didn't want to make sure that, and he said to the credit of the production designers, they did a very good job of getting the right cars and stuff like that, but that wasn't the focus. The focus was to actually make sure they caught the feeling of 79, the feeling of what these kids were doing and how they'd hang out and what they would say to each other and how the adults would act. And, you know, so it's all about that inside out type idea of getting the right era. And I think he succeeded with that really well because it does feel like 79. I remember that so well in America. I remember that era so well. And that is so accurate to the way we all were. We would just jump on bikes and go out and ride places. And if you really want to feel that, just go back and watch E.T. again. That's 82.
But I think you've also got to look at I mean, it's interesting, as you say, that's your... Do you want... Can I cut in for
yeah,
that?
Yeah, go for it.
If you were a kid then and you're in, you know, in America, that ability that you had a sense that things were safe and that you, you know, and basically your parents would wave you goodbye in the morning and you'd come back probably dirty, but... You were, that was it. You would just be cut loose for the day. There was none of that, where are you going? Here's a mobile phone. I'm now putting a, you know, GPS tracker under your skin. And it's something that possibly in some ways kids now would look at it and think, even if they, if, to say, well, you know, they're just let loose, as opposed to like for that age group versus now, it would be a much older age group.
Do you know what my
group.
Son said? Last night, my son actually looked at me and goes, God, I wish it was like that now. It's like he actually watches that and he goes, why can't we do that?
No. I remember as a kid watching things and thinking, why is the world a scarier place? But in reality, the world had always been a scary place in that way, but that wasn't my personal experience.
And the funny thing is, I actually don't think, and this is going to be controversial, and send me an email if you like, feedback@filmactually.com, but I actually don't think the world is actually that much scarier a place. I think what's happened is we've gotten much more paranoid about the world. Media has driven home this concept that it's a horrible, evil, dangerous place out there and everybody's out to get your children. When you actually look at statistics, the statistics aren't that much higher.
Well, technically speaking, the people who are going to get your children are in your own family.
That's right. And they were saying, statistically, it is higher that it's somebody you know that is going to molest your children rather than a stranger. Stranger danger is such an overbeaten thing.
Yeah, but I think the biggest issue, I mean, without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which is probably another form of abuse, but anyway, if you look at the fact that people didn't talk about that gear, if you say, well, what's better about our era right now is that people talk about that stuff. And yes, you can frighten shit out of a kid by talking about stranger danger, but if it cues them to even thinking, you know, Uncle Joe's weird, then that's a good thing. Now, bring back to the movie, the fact that the girl could sneak out at midnight, I'm not doing
this. And steal the father's car.
Incredibly muscle car-esque kind of a car, which would have made a fuckload of noise when it left the driveway. But that's
nobody slid across the bonnet. What are those blokes called?
Yeah.
Dukes of Hazzard style.
No.
But what I'm just saying is that the fact that kids could whip to another kid's house at midnight and that sort of thing, you know, was interesting in terms of that freedom and trust type of stuff. I mean, I have twin nephews and they're 12, and the fact they're going riding bikes with their friends around, I need a Valium and a Bex and a lie down and some counselling, but I needed that when one of them could adjust the shower on their own. But that's just me.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is? But that's exactly right. That's us. That's not
them.
That's
right. That's
those kids are actually ready to go out there and take on the world.
My brother-in-law.
And we're sitting there going, you can't do that.
My brother-in-law used to do a 6-suburb cycle on his bike and wasn't seen till dusk.
Yeah,
you know,
we had a simple rule. Once you left the house, you know, in the morning, you go off to school, because we used to go ourselves to school. There was none of this taking your kids to school. We used to walk ourselves to school and walk. And basically the only rule was be home before the sun goes down. You know,
when the vampires come out.
That's right.
It's like, you know,
because once it's dark, it means it's dinner time. Be home for dinner, you know, and that was kind of it. And we were just cut loose.
But then you'd be at some kid's house and then they'd go, the mother would go, it's dinner time, go home. Like, you know, go to your own place. It was that sort of deal.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, but it, as a filmmaker, he has said that he loved working with that era because there was so much less, things you had to plan for. Like, in today's, if a film's set today, you have to think constantly about the fact that, oh, no, a cell phone would mean that wouldn't happen. Oh, no, they would have just gone online and got that. It's like, he was saying that working in that era was a real freedom in itself. And
what did he say? I love his quote where he said, the cell phone is the death of drama.
Oh, that was so good.
You're right.
Yeah, you're right.
Absolutely. That's why we loved it. It was just such a great line. The cell phone really is the death of drama. It's like, it's so much easier to build up tension when you can't just call someone. Like nowadays, you literally have to have that moment where it's like, oh, my cell phone's out of battery.
Whoa.
When does that ever happen?
So action-packed. Listeners, he just knocked his mic over.
And look, and we would have had the situation like as you said, I think it was you that said in the round table, where basically as soon as this strange thing started happening, everybody would have had the cell phones out, pictures would have been taken, the monster would have been all over the news.
CNN would have been in it, and the paparazzi would have said something, and Paris Hilton would have had a thing on it, and Paris Hilton would have had a date with it, you know.
Or made a home porn tape with it or something. James from Melbourne in our chat room, by the way, we go out live every week and you can come and join our chat room. Go to geekactually.com/live every Saturday. James from Melbourne has said, but our children aren't as independent as we were. Well, actually, I disagree. I think think we have made them not as independent Absolutely. As we were.
I agree with
Children
that.
Are the same. We have coddled them. We have covered them in cotton wool, and we sit there going, we've got to keep them safe. We've gone completely the opposite to the way we used to be.
I'm going to pull rank here, though, and say we are talking about a film, though, so let's come back.
Let's go back to the film, and I'm going to jump in with mine, and I'm going to say, because I'm dying to hear what Katrina has to say about this, because she's been... she's been reticent about telling us anything, so I'm dying to get there, but I'm going to get mine out there, because my review is already public, so everybody knows how I feel. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think it was the best film I have seen this year so far, unless something extraordinary happens before December, it's probably going to be my favorite film of the year, purely because it is not a sequel, it's not superheroes, it is not a remake, a reboot, a reimagining. This is even though it is an homage to films of that era, it is so fresh, so original, so alive. I think the performances from the children are staggering. In particular, Joel and Elle as the two leads. I think
especially Elle. I think Elle steals the film.
She is mesmerizing. And I think the fact that he's managed to capture that whole sense of that young connection, the budding almost romance that is happening between these two characters – from getting this sort of performance out of two 12-year-olds is not an easy task, and it is...
Especially considering in the interview he says that apart from Elle, none of the other ones had ever been
except for we found out later the kid who likes the firecrackers and the pyrotechnics.
I've seen him.
He was from Star Trek. He was the kid. He was James Kirk as the kid from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Crashes the
car. But Joel
Joel had never been on a set before.
Like, that's an amazing performance for someone who's
very
fresh.
Vulnerable.
And like he was saying that the scene where, and this is not really spoilers, it's just a little character piece, but the scene where he's teaching her how to be a zombie, and she starts approaching him, and he's like staring at her and not knowing what to do. That's real. He said that was such a real emotion. She just went into that, and he was literally paralyzed because he didn't know what to do. And it's a really amazing scene because it feels so fresh. It feels so real. Mm. And they managed to pull this off without feeling soppy, without feeling sappy. You know, it actually feels I keep coming back to that word feel. This film has emotion. It's what Josh said. This film has a heart. And it's got a really solid heartbeat. And I think that is probably the most important thing about this film. I'm going to quote our friend Richard Gray, who couldn't be on the show this week because he is off at the Sydney Film Festival. But Richard Gray came out of the theater, and I said, what did you think? And he summed it up, and Richard can be found at therealbits.com. He summed it up by saying, it was like opening a box of kittens. Because it was just that warm, soft feeling.
And they were still alive.
And it was just they were soft and cuddly and warm and comfortable. And, you know, it's just everything about this film just, for me, worked. And I sat there watching it going, it harked back to a time, probably my favorite era of film, which is that whole Amblin or late 70s, early 80s generation of film. It gave me that feeling again without trying to be a copy of those films. It just felt like one of those films.
And the other thing that I really liked was the fact that I felt they almost modernized the concept a little bit by making it that tad bit more violent, like that tad bit more heavy, because... I found it really unique to see a film where you had those moments you would have had in an old Amblin film where you would have, you know, the fact that you thought someone was dead or whatever and it turns out it wasn't, it was fake blood or something like that.
Yeah.
You had those, but then you had real violence moments. And this will speak to an audience that is, like, in the chat room people are saying that children aren't as mature as we were. I completely disagree. Kids these days, man, 10, 11 years old, a hell of a lot more...
And they're better informed these days.
No, there's a difference between being worldly and being mature.
Yeah.
There's a difference between, you know, being able to access porn and use all the current swear words and have the moral compass of Paris Hilton. It is not the same thing as being
absolutely
mature.
Absolutely not, but in the context that I'm putting it in, which is that I'm saying when we're talking about films and we're talking about movies, they are more desensitized than we were.
But could you also argue, though, that maturity can also come from independence? And the fact that in that era of film, those kids were so much more independent that they actually formed that maturity out of that, where we don't give them that much independence today, so therefore they don't develop the same maturity.
It's sort of a double-edged sword. I mean, you've got independence because those kids are running around doing their own thing, but there's the same. There's a fine line between being cut loose and being independent and being neglected because no bugger fed that kid. You know, like what I'm saying is, and I'm sort of starting to stray into my review, but I feel... that even though it sounds like we're discussing generational things, what you guys have also got to realise is that in the 79, not you because you're a bit younger, but I'm 5 years older than David, is that you're on the inside. You've only got the feeling of it as opposed to, and when you're that age, you think you're so incredibly sophisticated and mature and you're probably a bozo and you can't, you know, match your socks. But what I'm saying is that these kids were cut loose. They worked as a team, I think, which was a special element of the relationship. And as you said, in terms of balancing those character traits that were pulled together.
Oh, go ahead and continue, Katrina, because I'm pretty much done. All I'm going to say is that for further details, you can read my review. But this film, James Melbourne actually said he thinks it's the best film in the last 5 years. I probably even agree with that. This is a staggering film for me. It was a film that I didn't know I was missing. And then when I saw it, it's like, wow, I didn't know I was missing that so much.
Yeah, no, but just to finish off my point, what I'm saying with that is not a conversation on how to raise kids or maturity and levels of kids. It's like kids watch things now in a lot of cases that that are more violent because as time has progressed, like as an example, they would watch horror movies just like I would watch horror movies at my age, but the problem is horror movies now are a lot more intense than when I watched horror movies. So they are a little bit more desensitized, and a lot of kids that come through the stores play MA-15 games. They all play Call of Duty at 11 or 12 and, you know, blow heads off and stuff like this. And, you know, agree with that or disagree with that. It's not the point. The point is it's a reality, and it is actually here, and it's around us, and it's something that is there. And if you release something that has no edge to it, kids these days kind of will turn off to it because they're just not interested. They're like, I've seen worse. I'd rather shoot someone, blah, 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 blah. And to see a film that still keeps the heart, still keeps the story, still keeps the adventure, but then just throws in a few moments where you are genuinely surprised that they would go that far.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when you actually see blood or someone actually dies. Like that isn't something that Amblin would have agreed with 15, 20 years ago. You know what I mean?
What do you mean agreed with? What, they wouldn't do it.
Well,
I think they would have done it. Absolutely, they would have done it. I got to tell you, when I saw, let's go back in time. Let's hit the Wayback Machine and go back in time. When I saw Gremlins, I was probably 14 or 15 when I saw Gremlins. No, actually, it was a bit later, 16 maybe. Mm-hmm. My lovely wife, Katie, who I was dating in high school, was actually 2 years younger than me. So she was, 14 or whatever it was. Mm. She was so petrified in that first 25, 30 minutes of Gremlins. She was actually clinging to my arm saying, I think I want to go. I think I want to leave. And then it changes gears and goes into the funny Gremlins, and she actually really enjoyed the film. Mm. And this is something that we talked about with Super 8, which was it's something that we used to do, and
which
we don't do anymore.
Shock, not
which is we used to actually respect our young and our kids and so forth to say you can actually deal with a little bit more than we give you credit for.
Yeah, look,
we can actually
throughout history, Hansel and Gretel, all these sort of things. It's like
Brothers Grimm. Yeah.
Brothers Grimm.
Exactly.
I used
to tell these kind of stories.
I saw Poltergeist when I was 14 years old, and Poltergeist is an amazing, fun film that I really, really enjoyed.
The dichotomy we're talking about is the difference between suspense and then that leads into horror or the payoff, whether it be the blood or the oogie thing or whatever it is. Mm. And you're saying that, they're playing these games and they're getting the quick payoff of the gut spilling out of somebody that they've just gored in a war game versus that real sense of the tension being built up. And what that means from a suspense perspective, in a way, is more gratifying than often seeing the thing, which is part of what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Look, I think. I think there we also have to really define the fact that there is a very big difference between gore films and splatter porn and what have you, and suspense horror and suspense horror or suspense thrillers.
Well, just taking them as concepts, taking them instead of calling suspense horrors and like a movie genre, just suspense and horror. It's like these kind of things can be put into
film. I'm talking about the viewer's sense of satisfaction, for want of a better word, or the payoff in terms of how it moves the plot line forward.
Exactly.
Like, these days, my attention span is so short that when I rent a movie that possibly has people walking down dark corridors, I'm so impatient, I fast forward. Hurry up. Double time. Let's go. Snap, snap. Oh, yes, and around the corner. No, not that corner, not that corner. Oh, there was the thing. Back up a bit. And
well, wait a while.
Which is exactly what the filmmaker didn't intend.
No, that's absolutely true. All right, Katrina, let us hear it. You heard it. Josh really liked it. I liked it probably even more than Josh.
I'm so incredibly excited.
I'm so curious.
To hear what you have to say.
Hit us with it.
All right. I liked the plot line. I mean, I'll talk about the kids briefly because you guys, I think, have covered that well and succinctly and articulately. They were great. They had great chemistry. I actually have a question before I launch in. When you were talking to J.J. Abrams, how much was this, because obviously it's done with Steven Spielberg as producer, how much was this done in concert with him or under his umbrella or in his arc?
What we gathered from what we've read and what J.J. said was basically he called Spielberg and said, I want to make this film. Spielberg said, yeah, fine. And J.J. went off and made his film. So it sounds to me like Spielberg did not have his hand in day-to-day running of this production. This is a J.J. Abrams film. Mm. Now, J.J. Abrams grew up. J.J. Abrams is 1 year older than me. Right. So he's obviously he's really in tune with that era and that style of film. That's obviously what he really likes.
Yeah.
It was very important for him to have the Amblin logo at the beginning. Yeah. So he really needed Spielberg to produce this. And Spielberg's name helped him get the whole film greenlit. Now, I don't think – and he also asked advice on how to direct kids and stuff like that because Spielberg gave him advice on how to direct kids. Mm. I don't think Spielberg had a hand in actually making the film.
The guy knows Spielberg better than most because
– well, it's like he studied him. It's like he's done a thesis on him.
He actually – when he worked in – what was it, Cutting or something like that? He actually had some of Steven Spielberg's old Super 8 films – that he actually had to do. So this guy knows Spielberg better than anyone, which is why it comes across.
The
feeling
of homage and...
Look, I actually wrote that in my review. I said, how would this work, Spielberg producing an homage to himself? Because it almost sounds conceited to do that. And it doesn't... Well, for me, it didn't come across that way because this is very much Abrams' film. And it's almost like Abrams gave Spielberg a love letter and basically said, this is... for you. You know what I mean?
No, I think it's that wall with all the photos on it. I think it's beyond the love letter. It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what the phrase is.
It's the creepy geek room. I would actually open up and it's got the thing and the shrine and the picture with something stuck to the wall.
So to answer your question, I think that we could pretty much count this being as an Abrams film.
All right. Now I'll launch in. I really like Abrams.
Yeah.
I liked Lost. I got a bit lost in Lost, but then I found my way out. Hey?
Ba-dum-pum.
Yeah. I adored Star Trek. I could have given that man a cuddle.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the only thing that annoyed me about the Star Trek thing was the special features, which was supposedly the gag reel, but it was very much how many beatboxings can J.J. Abrams do. And it was very bum-kissing of Abrams. That was my only criticism. I adored Star Trek. I had an immense amount of respect for him. This film, what he got out of those kids was a very pure performance in the sense of it. There was no wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we're pretending to be innocent. Mm. And I think that was a really special thing. I think what's interesting from an acting perspective is the different energy that Elle has from Dakota.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's just a very different energy. And it's I don't want to use the word technique like the craft concept, but the way that girl worked was the vulnerability.
It felt real.
It did. You know, it wasn't like, you know how sometimes towards the end of the child acting career of, the little kid out of Sixth Sense.
Oh, Haley Joel.
People decided he was a little machine and he was creepy.
Yeah.
You know.
Was it Haley Joel?
Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah.
To
me, that her acting just had that such a... an innocence and a vulnerability about it. I thought it was great. And I think your point about the time that he set it was that not knowing, like, you know, feeling, you know, you like him, he likes you, la-la stuff, as opposed to leaping loins and kids feeling that they've got to push themselves forward. So even though we've had this wide-ranging conversation about how far kids can go on their bikes and should they have cellular phones, I think one of the most interesting things that none of us have actually discussed, and it's probably in your review, but I deliberately didn't read it because I didn't want to colour what I was going to say, is that we don't have in this film the sexualisation of children.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the freshest things about it. It's not trying to push them forward, in a way that is, one, creepy, and two, voyeuristic.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I remember before the first 20-minute screening we got to see of just, you know, sort of basically the train yard scene, there was a little excerpt that they had got of J.J. Abrams talking, and one of the things that he said is when picking the cast, he wanted to go out and find kids that weren't that young L.A. crew.
Mm.
And it's so true, because it feels like the kids that just have a little bit less of this thrown in their face. Mm. Like, they're coming in, you know, acting aside, because any actor will be colored by the kind of upbringing they have had. And it's like when you grab these kids that are, you know, middle America or whatever, they live such a different lifestyle that you get a different feeling of actor from them. And it's like it allows for something that is different.
And I think that point that David touched on about the just burgeoning sexuality, like it's just there, but you've got that innocence and that ability for kids to run as a pack.
Mm. But it was also, and I think that was evidenced by the fact that Charles was saying, "I like her."
Yeah.
Mm. But I think the relationship between Joel and Elle was actually about connection.
Yes.
These two kids were finding each other as being really, really close.
Now, this is where I'm having a problem with the spoiler thing, because I wanted to talk about that, the nut of their relationship and why it was fraught, but I don't feel comfortable to do that from the anti-spoiler motto.
How spoilerish are we talking?
The mother, his mother.
Oh, well, isn't that in one of the trailers?
And I think it's one. There is actually a common thread in all of those early Spielberg films, which is the broken home.
Yeah.
And so J.J. Abrams set us up nicely with a broken home really early on in the piece. So,
okay.
So yeah, go for it. You can talk about that. That's fine.
All right. So in terms of the boy's mother, you know, being killed in a work accident, and really,
which is literally in the first second and a half of the movie. So
I thought that was quite elegant the way they showed that.
Yeah.
Mm. With the number of days without accident, and suddenly we were back to one. Mm. And to me, and also for the listeners, that the girl's father should have had the shift that day and he didn't.
Mm, mm, mm.
So the two kids' parents, the fathers, are at, you know, loggerheads about that and their relationship.
The two fathers are so damaged.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Because of this event that they can't relate to their own kids anymore.
No. Mm. You know? And I think, to me, there were some elegant ways that relationship, or the breakdown of the relationship, was shown. Like at one stage, the boy's father's a cop and there's all these cops sitting around a table, and he said, "There's two bits of pizza in the fridge for you." And the other cop said, "Oh, I ate that." And the father doesn't even say anything about the kids not being fed. And it was also touched on by Charles's mother early in the piece during the mother's funeral, saying, "I don't know how he's going to bring this kid up."
Yeah, he's never had to be a father before.
And to me, that almost felt like, I thought, were the parents separated? It was almost like it wasn't in the household.
No, because for me, what I got out of that was she was the housewife. He was her son.
Yeah.
And the father was the breadwinner.
It
was a very 70s thing, because remember there was actually a cartoon series in the 70s and late 70s called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home. And it was like the father went off and earned money and came back and issued discipline, but the mother did all the raising.
Mm.
You know, it was a very 70s approach to things. Yeah. You know?
Well, to me, and this is where I'm going to start my criticisms. I liked the plot in the sense of the tightly woven suspense thing. So when we touched on suspense before, and we're thinking, and I'm going to use my metaphors through a lot of Spielberg films here, remember why Jaws frightened the shit out of you? Because you didn't see it.
Yeah.
So in terms of the main, you know, menacing character within Super 8, you mostly don't see it.
Yeah.
And that's the times and the speed of it. I love it when a bad thing whips a person away quickly. I really enjoy that.
It's so effective.
And I think that's why I got so cranky with bloody The Wolfman, was because they did a bit of that at the beginning. And then by the time you saw The Wolfman, I've never seen a werewolf that satisfies me, ever. It's just so ridiculous. So to me, and I think the speed of it does two things about the nature of the menace. It shows its power, it shows its speed, but it also shows its ruthlessness. Mm. And I thought that was interesting. And to me, and this is where I've got to be careful of spoilers, at the end, when a bit more is revealed about it and its motivation, it felt very, I might be bad, or I might be good, oh, I don't know. Like that whole, you know, where it's got its trail mix prepared.
Mm.
You know, that was, I found that frustrating. All right, that's my first point.
Okay, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that later.
In spoilers. All right, talked about the characters, and I think the big motif of a lot of Spielberg films, particularly when you talked about kids ranging free, was that the kids are met with an issue, And the parent, they can't go to the parents for support. It's too big and awful, so the kids therefore are thrown onto their own. Like, we can't talk to the parents about that. So very much, you know, E.T.
It was that thing also that they wouldn't understand or they wouldn't believe. Like, that was always a not big believing. Concept.
But even in To Kill a Mockingbird, I've gone back as far as that the kids, you know, with that Beau character, the next-door neighbour, like... You know, it was about, we don't know how to deal with this. We don't know how to talk to our parents about this. So I think, as you say, maybe that one wouldn't believe us. So that the fact that kids are cut off from adult interaction. But at the same time, it almost felt, you know, when you're a kid, you're very clear on your own motivations and adults are a mystery. He did that very well, that the adults were a mystery, but from a plot and some, I don't know, back. Drops subtext. I just wanted a bit more of knowing what the adults' motivations were. I felt they were so light on, particularly the father, less so the drunken father of the Fanning girl. And particularly when the bad colonel gets his comeuppance, I felt it was so touched on so briefly that the revenge, for want of a better word, I'm being very careful in my dancing around spoiler language here, didn't have that, die horribly, bastard.
Actually, it's funnily enough, sorry, Josh, I think we're probably going to jump on the same thing. funnily enough, I actually, I like the fact that the adults weren't delved into that much, because for me, this film was from the kids' point of view. And so the adults, that's why I put the kids in the head of the cast, because I look at it and go, this is their world, and it's kind of like, what they're seeing of their parents, not from the parents' point of view.
No, you know? I wouldn't have minded that, except they had the mother at the funeral, Charles's mother, saying he won't know how to raise
the kids. Yeah, but
that's just
establishing something.
Yeah, I know, but I'd rather almost have it be the kids were in the bubble and then the parents were even more mysterious. Then, I don't know, that's what I'm saying.
I think if you go back and watch E.T. or any of those films from that era, the adults are shortchanged over the kids. The kids always had much more.
But see,
depth
I was younger then as well. So to me, that E.T. experience, I mean, I was a young adult. I was, I don't know, 18 or something when it came out. But to me, and the best indicator of E.T. was after the film came out, went into the ladies' toilet, there are like 40 women in there with bright red eyes weeping.
But if you didn't cry at E.T., you didn't have a soul.
Yeah. interestingly enough, I actually I'm not saying I agree or disagree. I actually think it's a very valid point about the parents. They don't have very good grounding, and there is that one scene which I didn't relate to very well, which is when, and this isn't a spoiler because it's not plot related in any way. Point: the father tells the son he can't do something, and the kid launches into him. The father's reasoning didn't follow any logic because he just didn't even care. And it felt a bit too harsh for me. But again, and these are small things, Dave, so don't bother jumping on top of it. The one I do disagree with, though, is the colonel, because the colonel dies violently, not in a, I tried to shoot it and then got dragged away because of my own insolence or my own stupidity. He just gets killed because... the monster is angry and after them and kills him. You can't give that character too much thing, otherwise it's a different effect for the audience. That's the only argument I would put against that.
And this
that.
Brings us to what Holly said in that email, where she actually said that she had trouble with the film. She wasn't a huge fan of the film. She liked it, but she said the problem she had, and this is where I had to violently disagree with her, she goes, because in this day and age, you know, left-wing Hollywood, she's been working for Fox far too long. She goes, left-wing Hollywood has basically made the evil military establishment the bad guy again and blah, blah, blah. And I had to write back to her and say, it is a film of its time. In 1979, the military were the bad guys. You know, there was we were in the middle of the Cold War.
Andromeda Strain.
Yeah, that's right. We were in the middle of the Cold War. We had the military were often portrayed as like the faceless bad guys.
You've even got a line in the thing during the town meeting where the lady actually jumps up
and
says,
"It's the Soviets." You know,
and if no one explains this to me better, I'm going to say it's the Soviets.
Right.
And it's just like that was. It's the paranoia of its time.
I also said there was two points to that. First one was because of its time period, you have to take into account the time period. I don't think this film in any way, shape, or form was having a go at the military, because they were one elite unit that was from the Air Force that was hiding something. Yeah. You know what I mean? And they were cleaning up their own mess. Second thing I had to say about that was that no matter who you choose as the bad guy today, somebody is going to protest.
Yeah,
when Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, the Indians jumped up and down and picketed the film because they thought Indians were portrayed badly. When Lethal Weapon 2 came out, the South Africans picketed the cinemas and jumped up and down because they thought that they were being portrayed too badly. When, you know, and you can go back.
Life of Brian.
The great thing about using military or anything like that is it doesn't have to be a race or a style of people. It's just this nameless, faceless thing, and that's why it's also really important to keep them incredibly uncharacteristic. Yeah. Just leave them without faces, because that's the important thing.
And all
thing
we had
them.
To do for Noah Emmerich's character to make his death justified was to show him acting ruthlessly throughout the film so that we can say he got his comeuppance. And he did a couple of really despicable things in that film, so you go, he deserved it. Mm. And as long as he deserved it, that's all that mattered.
I was ticking off. Yeah,
that was an 80s motif. You know,
I'm going to throw it all the way back to you in one of the last reviews we were doing and talk about the fact that it's a complete shift as to how the bad guy doesn't up, where the bad guy just literally follows and follows and follows and then gets thrown off the side of a plane and no one even thinks the wiser. It's like this is the other end of the scale where it's just brutally beat him to death, but the whole thing is he hasn't had any sort of character building, so you don't give a crap about him. So it's like they're tricks of the cinema. You know what I mean?
No,
it's
I agree
like,
with you about the up thing. I thought they were very light on about the. But I mean, in terms of the bad guy, the baddie. Can I make a statement about how he dies?
Save it for spoilers. We're going to do a quick five minutes.
Anyway, let me press on.
All right, press on. Okay, let's.
We're going to have to let her. We're going to have to make sure that we remember that when she's building a thing, because she's getting all these points where she's like, "Damn it, now I got to talk about this later."
I love the train smash. I like it. It's satisfying. It has power.
Mm.
I think whoever makes that particular brand of Super 8 camera should build an ad campaign around its toughness.
And the car.
The car, yes.
Yeah, I think the car survived unscratched.
Yes. And you know when you were talking about them having the war scene and they're all and the kids are whipping through houses and stuff like that? Do you know what annoyed me? And they made me think, oh, my God, I'm becoming an old fuddy-duddy. I couldn't stand the fact that when Charles and the other kid were in the house and they're going to be left alone for a particular reason, and there was that interchange between Charles and the main kid, you couldn't hear it because there were so many explosions in the background.
I actually really found that scene a little too over the top, because it's like they were just firing at anything.
That's
it
what
just
I thought.
Didn't make
I thought,
sense
I
to
thought,
me.
Well, there is a line where they say, because the guy's on the radio and he says, all of our machinery has gone crazy. Because remember, whenever the aliens are around.
No, that wasn't clear. That wasn't clear.
No, I didn't get that.
Was thinking, where's the main baddie? Because why? What are they shooting at?
No, because he actually says, there's a guy on the radio, as they first come in and everything's shooting everywhere, he says, he's on the radio and he says, we've lost control of everything.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. James
from Melbourne heard it as well.
Yeah, he says, we've lost control. Okay, so everything is driving
that
wild.
Makes, probably for both of us, then, that makes a little bit more sense. Because I was sitting there the whole time
what are you shooting at? Because then we're seeing the cutaway to where the other hmm's happening. And you think, well, he's not there.
Yeah.
No, all the machinery had gone crazy.
That was really unclear.
Yeah.
And from a
it's a bit of a throwaway line, too, because, yes, I mean, it's machines doing stuff and things like this, but it hadn't really hit power. Nothing was being yanked out of the ground and things weren't lifting up. So why was it going crazy?
They don't explain why.
Yeah, now you see that. Yeah. I have a bit of a problem with
that. I think they just wanted to have a very spectacular.
But you know what I found
scene?
Very satisfying? When the tank ran over this kid's playground. I don't know why. I must have had a bad experience there. Yes! I can kill it! Okay, all right.
It's also just one time destruction.
James from Melbourne in our chat room says the military hates suburbia. That's all it comes down to. Okay.
No, James, that's where they want us to live so they can experiment on us.
Okay, Katrina, wrap it up.
I'm sorry. I love the effects. The sound thing annoyed me, and I wanted to just got a spoiler about the And I really liked it. I liked the kids. I agree with everything you said about the prepubescent angst and the But somehow I came out of it slightly dissatisfied. And I have been grappling with this since Thursday night. I thought, I have to tell them why. And I go through my normal things and I can't tell you why I feel that I was slightly let down.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's interesting.
I think that's a rip-off for the listeners, and I apologise, listeners. I've been searching my heart for why, against my criteria, I felt that
way. And I find that really interesting because I came out with the absolute opposite experience, which is I came out the most satisfied out of a cinema that I've come out in years.
I felt happier bowling out of X-Men.
Interesting. Wow. Interesting. Okay.
Now, can we hit these spoilers?
We're going to hit the
spoilers. I want to talk so much to you about all these things that you have hidden from us.
Okay, we have on the clock right now, we've got our 5-minute spoiler counter. Okay.
Can we have a noise for it as well?
We don't have a noise. So for our audio listeners, we're going to tell you when it starts. And all you have to do at that point is fast forward exactly 5 minutes because we will stop at exactly the 5-minute mark. Finished or not. Okay. So are you ready, Katrina?
I'm ready.
And here we spoiler start now.
In no particular order, I enjoyed the alien. I enjoyed its crab-like movements. I liked the fact that where it dug out its hole, it had like little scrapy nails. That
now,
was all
do you
fun.
Remember a film? I've said this to a couple of people. Nobody knows this film. So, do you remember a film from 1980? I think it's 83 or 84 called Extro. And the caption on the poster was not all extraterrestrials are friendly. It was this real ripoff of E.T.
No, I didn't know that one.
And the monster was a biped that walked kind of odd. And all I could think was this thing feels like it's related
to
Extro
in
some way.
Abrams would do something like that.
Yeah, he would. Somebody in our chat room has said that they read a review and the reviewer stupidly said that this was one of Cloverfield's babies. And all I could think is whoever wrote that review, never read them again because that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard.
But I want to say about the alien's face. Right?
Yep.
He picks the kid up and the kid, they're having their psychic connection because that's what happens, listeners, when the alien touches you, you have a psychic connection with it, lala. And he's looking into this thing's face and all I could think was Optimus Prime. Bloody hell. You know, I felt,
it's
yes,
like an organic
it doesn't,
version.
It was. And I thought, okay, you don't have to go the full crab and be like Predator with a You don't have to do that. But it was so, you know.
See, I loved his
Optimus
face.
Optimus Prime.
I loved his face, and I actually really liked that moment after he.
I liked his eyes opening and the second lead coming
up. I like the fact that as soon as he makes the connection with the kid, the second things roll back, and his eyes are actually very human looking.
Just quickly
under the
while
surface.
We're on this subject, that is my favorite moment of dialogue in the entire film. Bad things happen. Yeah, that kid's delivery of that line just went straight through me.
And J.J. Abrams actually made comment about that as well, which I thought was really fascinating, where he actually said that scene was written because everything that that kid says is stuff that he's saying to himself.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
And,
I know.
It's,
yeah,
and
know.
It's what he
comforting
needs to
himself.
Hear. Yeah, and it's a wonderful piece
now,
of dialogue.
No, I loved that moment in terms of the kid and that, but the alien's face annoyed me. Cool. And also I laughed at the fact that when the, you know, everyone's hanging upside down as he's like, you know, grocery list ready to eat and he's eating the leg and stuff like that. And they go and they flip between the, oh no, we've had a psychic connection with him. He's very angry. He's very hurt. Oh my God, he seems to be eating people. And to me, it was such, it didn't feel, the flip-flop between, no, he's touched me. I can understand he's been abused for, you know, 40 years. And, oh my God, he's going to eat me. And the people hanging around. I can say, that's why I said trial mix. Because it was just so silly, that ability to flip on it.
I've been thinking about this because I actually agreed with you about a week ago and it was after the first screening. I was very confused at that. But I look at it and I go, why does it have to be that it's a nice guy or a bad guy? The fact that he is
something that eats flesh. We do. We know that from the black and white
exactly.
film.
Yeah. We know he eats flesh and humans have done nothing but treat him like shit. Why would he not eat us?
We're a handy food source for it.
Well, see, I thought that's what the backstory with the dogs was at the beginning when they all went missing.
That's what I thought.
Yeah,
and
I love the fact that it was just them being scared. I thought that
was
terrific.
Well, no, but it may have actually been that. They may have sensed that this thing was going to fucking eat them.
No,
so
they found
all
them all in. No, that's what they were very
no,
clear.
No, so the dogs may have sensed
away
them.
Yeah.
And said, we're out of here.
They knew there was a big predator on town. So they were just like, all right, guys, we're going to make camp miles away from here. All right, let's go.
All right, so we got a minute 40 left on the spoilers. Anything else?
Yes. When the teacher's in the car,
yeah.
I wanted less of the teacher to be there. I'm sorry. You don't drive into a train and have half your car there and you're sitting there with a couple of scratches on you. Really, I wanted him missing from the waist down.
Interesting.
You know?
Didn't bother me at all, that sequence.
It did a bit as well.
I've been hit by a train and I've got a map and a gun. I think he would have been vaporized in that accident.
But the fact that he wasn't, it's fine, you know?
But again, that's the geek in me that used to watch films and be like, you can't survive that. It's not someone that was actually bothered plot point wise. I was just looking at it going, I'm sorry, that's silly.
Okay, the other thing was.
1 minute.
You know how Spielberg... No, all right. So that, you know, when there's the big denouement between the two fathers in the car and he rescues the bloke and he goes, it was an accident. I'm sorry, I worked in OHS for 7 years. There's no such thing as an accident. It's a fucking breakdown in procedures. Now, back to my last question. I do it annoys me. It's a fucking accident.
Keep going. excited. Keep going.
All right.
It's so cool.
You know how there was always in Spielberg's films, there was the doppelganger of him. So in Saving Private Ryan, it was the skinny guy with the dark hair was him. That was his eyes. Remember, there was always a Spielberg.
I can already answer this. Yeah.
Who is the doppelganger?
Charles.
For Spielberg?
No. Oh, no, for J.J. Abrams.
For J.J. Abrams.
No, it wasn't. He said in an interview he was more of the Joe character.
Well, he was kind of like Spielberg a hybrid of the
was,
two.
No, yeah. Spielberg that, was his...
And the last thing that annoyed me was there always had to be the ubiquitous fat kid. That was a real Spielberg motif that pissed me off.
But what a great line when he says, I haven't slendered out yet. My doctor says it'll happen any day.
That was a good line. Okay, I'm done.
Time! Okay, and that's it for spoilers. That's exactly 5 minutes on the clock.
That wasn't spoiler. I just wanted to ask the question. What's sure. wrong with having fat people in films?
Nothing. But for Spielberg, it was like a bloody demographic breakdown.
No. Do you want to know something? All right, I'm going to completely counter you on this one, and I'm actually going to say to you that as a child who actually always carried weight on him, I always carried weight. One thing I loved about Spielberg films was that he always had somebody like me in his films who wasn't the joke, who was taken seriously, who actually did just get to be one of the characters.
No, I'll agree with you on that on Charles, but I will totally go hard against you on Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you had the fat kid that was the buddy with him when you find out why he was scared of snakes.
Yeah, but that was an older Spielberg. That was a much later era.
And it's still a fat kid.
We're talking about this era. We're talking about his heyday. In his heyday, when I was kids. I didn't like Last Crusade when it came out because I felt that it wasn't Spielberg. This didn't feel like Spielberg.
But I agree, because I'm saying that I mean, I liked Charles because Charles was a doer. He was a thinker. You know,
think about the Goonies, right?
I hated the Goonies.
Okay, but think about the Goonies. The fat, chubby kid who was the joke with everybody and blah, blah, blah was the one who ended up befriending the big, heavy monster and was the one who saved the day in the end. And so you look at it and you go, he always made the outsider feel welcome. And that was one of the Spielberg's, because he always himself, he said he felt awkward as a child. So he always tried to make the outsiders fit in.
I don't have a problem there being a fat kid, but it was the fat kid that was like the running after and, you know, like that's what really annoyed me about Raiders. Not Raiders.
Yeah, but I think you got to be careful of your eras as well. Spielberg was a very different filmmaker by the time he hit Last Crusade.
So you're saying I'm not allowed to draw the string between the man of the 70s and the man in that era?
Well, I think it's a different man. No, it's a different man. That's the problem. His films. Spielberg was actually...
was he, in fact, you know, doing a pastiche of himself when he did that?
Sorry?
Was he like... Well, I'm asking. You're saying he's not the same man, and yet that was a real strong motif of his thing is, you know, a thin kid, a fat kid, a la-la kid, whatever.
But what I'm saying is by the time he reaches Last Crusade, he's not... empowering that outsider anymore. He's laughing at the outsider. And that's it's a very different era.
All of tragedy.
Oh, yeah, it is a tragedy. And it's
you see that it's almost like he's cannibalizing on his own thing? I have done this in other eras. This is my stand.
And Spielberg has been heavily criticized for this over the years because his style of filmmaking, his era of the blockbuster Spielberg where he could do no wrong, basically, ended at about the 85, 86 mark.
Oh,
right?
Really?
Yeah, because if you look at it, I mean, he still made blockbusters, but he wasn't the same filmmaker. And do you know the film that was the real eye-opener for all of this was Hook? Because Hook was not a very good film.
Fucking awful.
That's
film.
Right. And you sit there and look at it and go, this is Spielberg material. Everything about this film should have worked. He should have been able
and
to
you're exactly
turn
right.
this
and
into
that
magic.
Kids, every one of those kids...
was annoying.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
And it's almost a bit like what Josh was saying, which was they were like almost LA kids.
And do you know what it is? Spielberg grew up, got married, and had kids. And as soon as he had kids of his own, he was not the kid anymore. Spielberg, as a filmmaker, always related to the kids. He was the Peter Pan. And if you look at those early films, Spielberg had a particular style that he could never do today. He could not make Jaws today. There is no way he could make that film today because he's got a slightly more politically correct eye on everything now. And he does, even when he did Jurassic Park, everybody said it was going to be Jaws on land. Jurassic Park is a pale comparison to Jaws, right? And so you said, don't get me wrong, I love Jurassic Park.
No, but
it
the
is
kids
nowhere
had a naturalist
near,
still.
Yeah, that's right.
To
but
them.
It is nowhere near the power or raw energy that Jaws is.
Oh, yeah.
When you look at.
I wonder in some cases whether or not you could actually say Spielberg was channeling. What's his name? Sam Neill's character in that then.
He kind of was, yeah. When he said, I hate kids.
He kind of has that feeling where it's like the kids are annoying, but at least there's a reason. Like he's kind of understanding why they're annoying. Like they're cute, but annoying.
Yeah, no, I could debate this all day long. We won't do it. But, I mean, there's a turning point in Spielberg's career.
No, I find that interesting. And that's why I like to...
And that's why I say
show.
My favorite era of film is before he hit that turning point. When he was still in his prime, when he was a single
don't
man.
Don't start me on Kate Capshaw.
No, well, she was after that though, because turning point for him was his first wife, who her name has gone out of my
Amy. She was in Yentl.
Crap, yes, she was. Anyway, and his first son Max, and it was from that point. Basically, where he started to change after that point.
Because I know therapists that work in pediatrics.
What is her name? Amy.
Anyway.
God.
James from Melbourne. How can you say that Kate Capshaw is lovely, be nice? She was the most striped, disgusting creature in the second Indiana Jones movie. I'd have fed her to the bloody crocodiles.
And she's a homebreaker. She was the one who actually said...
She was a machine. Yeah. She set her cap for Spielberg, and she went after
And it him. Wasn't Temple of Doom. A lot of people sit there and say, oh, she was given Temple of Doom because she got cast in Temple of Doom, and it was while making that film she decided she wanted Spielberg. Yes. And she actively pursued him to the point where the... Amy Irving, thank you very much.
It just came to me.
Amy Irving, where she basically broke that marriage up and got Spielberg. So she was a cold, manipulative, conniving woman who got exactly what she wanted. Anyway, and not a great actress. Can I just state that for the record?
Yes, and my evidence for that is Just Cause, Sean Connery.
Oh, I forgot about that one. I was actually thinking Space Camp.
That was a mad little laugh, wasn't it?
All right. Final words. Do you recommend it to your friends or not? Katrina.
Yes, I do. And yes, I would take my nephews.
Fantastic. Josh.
You know, I love this film. Best film of the year.
And I don't think I have to say anything. Yes, and I've already taken my 12-year-old, who Nikki thinks it is one of the greatest films ever made.
I know.
He just loved it.
He won't stop going on.
No, he won't. And I think it's because it comes out, he got a thrill. He got excited. He got scared. He got... resolution, he related to the leads in it, everything worked for him. So,
and I think that's a very, really important point. You think about films that you saw at a certain age, and I think we've had this conversation before, and some of them, you can watch them in 20 years' time and you're still there, and other ones, they aren't the film that you saw and it's a disappointing experience.
Absolutely.
Because it's that, as you say, it's the resonance within you at that age or whatever.
All right, considering that we're on the one-hour mark, we should really move on. All right, Sorry. So everybody out there, go see Super 8. There's something in it for somebody. Okay. All right, first piece of news this week in our news is Fright Night, the remake, gets a second trailer. Now, anybody who reads geekactually.com knows that I really hate this film, all right? And I haven't even seen it. I hated the first trailer, and the second trailer doesn't fare much better, but I thought we'd include it today because it at least has David Tennant in it, which the first trailer just ignored him completely.
I love David Tennant.
Oh, so do I. And the reasons why I don't like this are laid out in a post that I put onto the site, but basically... they've taken a film that was a product of its time. It was humorous. It was fun. It was exactly what we're talking about. It was a fun horror film that had some scary moments in it, some really good stuff.
It was deep fried Mars bar.
Thank you. And what they did was excellent.
Really good.
And what they did was they have now taken it and stripped out all the humor and basically turned it into a serious film. So it's not Fright Night anymore.
Yeah.
So why is it called Fright Night? And I don't mind if they want to make this film. Just don't call it Fright Night. Don't try and call it a remake because it doesn't resemble the original film in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, my chicken's fallen down. It's jumped.
It died. All right, so here's the trailer. Have a look at this. This is the new Fright Night.
Hi, Mrs. Brewster. Hi, girls.
Did you make a sacrifice to the hot ass gods? How do you get that?
Oh, Jerry, this is my son, Charlie. Jerry's our new neighbor.
Hey.
Hey.
I hate to be the one to tell you this, but that guy, your neighbor,
Jerry, since he moved in, people are disappearing.
I think he's a vampire.
You read way too much Twilight.
This is real. He kills, he feeds, and he doesn't stop until everybody's dead.
Hey, guy, you got a lot on your shoulders for a kid. Your mom and your girl, it's on you to look out for them. You up for that, guy?
Mr. Vincent, I need your expertise.
You want to know how to kill a vampire? Seriously?
You're going to need an army.
You bit off more than you can chew.
Oh, God. I'm going to end him or he's going to end me.
Hit him!
Did I kill him?
Let's kill something.
Obviously, you can't get in without an invitation.
Don't need an invitation if there's no house. We did our.
That's the best line in the whole trailer.
That's good, isn't it?
All right, Josh, you're the horror fan here.
I'm curious.
Yeah. Katrina, have you seen the original Fright Night, I take it?
I have. A long, long time ago when dinosaurs walked the earth. Yes, I did. Though I won't be seeing that on the big screen unless you tell me to go. I will wait for it on DVD like a big scab that I am.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I'm going to wait for DVD. Josh will go see it at the cinema.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. No deep insights into it at all?
No, I don't have anything to compare it to. I haven't seen the original.
Haven't you seen the original?
It wasn't available in my town on video or DVD.
Oh, wow. I've got it downstairs.
Done.
All right, time for you to watch Fright Night. All right, now.
Dude, please show people that picture. That's amazing.
we'll get to that picture in a minute. Okay, the reason we have this picture is at ainitcool.com, one of their reporters who goes by the name of Quint had a amazingly candid interview with Steven Spielberg this week, talking about all sorts of things. And this was all spawned because Jaws is about to come out on Blu-ray.
Ooh.
And Spielberg came out with a statement basically saying Jaws is coming out on Blu-ray, no changes, no manipulation, no changes.
He's not doing a George Lucas.
Funnily enough, I said fuck yeah, and then read, and then went actually out loud fuck yeah, yeah, when I actually read his reasoning, because I never understood why I didn't want it to happen until he said it.
Let's have a listen to Steven Spielberg. I've actually got a little bit of the audio now on the actual interview. The link is in the show notes, and it's a very long interview, but there's little moments where he's actually incorporated the audio to a couple of bits, and one of the bits he included was this, which is actually talking about George Lucas. The interviewer basically says, wouldn't it be nice if you could tell George that, right? So have a listen to this. This is from the interview.
I know, I totally understand that. Puppy. But there is going to be no more digital enhancements or digital additions to anything based on any film I direct, in the future.
Oh, yeah?
I'm not going to do any corrections digitally to even wires that show.
Yeah.
If 1941 comes on Blu-ray, I'm not going to go back and take the wires out.
because
the Blu-ray will bring the wires out that are guiding the airplanes down Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
But at this point right now, I think that letting movies exist in the era with all of the flaws and with all of the flourishes is a wonderful way to mark time and mark history.
I'm in total agreement with you. I wish you could talk George into doing the same thing.
Well, I can't.
Yeah, I know. I don't think anybody can. But
George goes his own way, and I respect him for it. But my new philosophy about this is to let sleeping dogs lie.
That's great for film geeks. That's, you know, anybody who appreciates film, that's like music.
And when people ask me, which E.T. they should look at, I always tell them, look at the original 1982 E.T. And you notice when we did put out E.T., we put out two E.T.s. We put out the digitally enhanced version with the additional scenes, and for no extra money in the same package, we put out the original 82 version. I always tell people to go back to the 82 version.
And that's great, and having the option is the big deal.
Absolutely, and this is one of the things Australian distributors have never learned, because in Australia, E.T. doesn't come with the bonus disc.
And I'm sorry, but that guy, I'm not sure if it was because it was a Skype interview or something like that, but that was a horrible interview.
it actually works better in print.
What's James from Melbourne
saying?
Okay,
James from Melbourne is saying that he's an absolute liar because he changed for the post-release for the DVD of E.T., because E.T. had that anniversary edition where they removed the shotguns and put the walkie-talkies in, and they put a digital E.T. in some scenes. What he's saying, James, is that he's had a change of heart about all of
this. It's his new philosophy.
He's basically started to look at what's happening out there. If you read the whole interview, it's a lot more in detail. Basically, over the years, it is starting to annoy him more and more and more, like us, how people keep reinventing the wheel or reinventing films. And he basically has now said, now with Blu-ray being as crystal clear as it is and everything, I want my films to come out that way, but I don't want them touched. And it makes it sound like the E.T. changes were instigated by the studio. He did them, but they were instigated by the studio for the release. And what he's saying is he doesn't like those changes. He says, go back and watch the 82 version if you're going to watch E.T. And I completely agree. And I had to actually buy my copy from America as a deluxe collector's edition for huge amounts of money because all I wanted was the 82 version.
That's amazing.
I didn't want the special edition. No. So I had to buy the collector's edition to get that. Now, apparently, the E.T. release in America has both, which is standard. Here, it's not. If you buy E.T., you only get the anniversary edition, which sucks. Mm. And I would say to Universal right now, if you are listening, which they probably aren't, release 82's version, you know?
Now, as a side question, I imagine you guys have seen the South Park edition about Spielberg and George Lucas?
Which one? They actually believe they've done a couple
of
things.
The one about where they it was after the release of the Crystal Skull.
And no, I didn't see this.
Is that the one with the opening of the arc at the end of it?
No, it's the one where Spielberg and Lucas keep raping all their characters to death.
Well, yeah, I think we have to give Spielberg a little bit of benefit of doubt on this. This is the first time he's publicly come out and said this sort of stuff. So,
well, this episode was probably a good 6-12 months ago.
Yeah, it would have been a while ago.
Yeah, it was a very powerful episode.
In the past he did this, but you got to remember as well that anniversary edition of E.T. came out in 2002. Mm. There's been a lot of years under water, a lot of water under the bridge.
Well, so. And look, I mean, there are only a few people I will do this for in cinema history, but Steven Spielberg is one of those guys who's usually on the front end of these things, the concept of revamping DVDs or something like that. It was a new experience for them being able to go back and fix things that they had maybe gone wrong. In the same way that, like, if someone told you that for no extra ability we could fix up, you know, the breaks in your artwork or whatever and, you know, actually repair it, you'd probably be looking at it going, oh, well, you know, it's awesome. I would like to see my look better. And it's like, then it's just a natural progression. It's like, was there anything that bothered you about the last film? You're like, well, yeah, I guess today I wouldn't like my kids to see, you know, people pointing guns at E.T., and he's like, well, we could change that. And he's like, all right. And then when you see the effects of what happens, someone like him's at a point where he'll see the South Park episodes. He'll see the things that'll come out or at least hear about them and be like, people don't like this. Why? And he's the kind of person who has the brain power to introspectively.
But whereas George Lucas might be into that level of arrogance now that's, you know.
Well, I was about to say, the difference between George Lucas and Steven Spielberg is Steven Spielberg obviously heard the criticism and said, oh, people don't like this and people want it to be left alone, so we will. Whereas George Lucas goes, it's my film, I'll do it my way.
Mm.
But I mean, you know, even the remastering shit they put into, you know, Star Wars 4, you know, was just an abomination.
It was just unnecessary and doesn't fit.
You know, it's like marrying somebody and by the time you've been with them for a couple of years, they've got fake tits and replaced knees and one glass eye. You know, like how much of the real thing is still there when you keep fiddling with it?
Yeah.
Isn't that...
Yeah.
And, I mean, when people make an Amish quilt, they deliberately build a floor in. But in a way, when you've watched something at a certain point in your life and you love a film, sometimes it's the very flaws of the film is the thing that you love.
And I like what Arseface is saying. It's like censoring the penis from Michelangelo's
David, which is what they tried to do in one of the American. Remember, one of the American cities that want to actually cover it up.
Yeah,
it's like stop it, just leave it alone. It's a piece of art. You know what I mean? It's
but there was a whole era where they bloody put, you know,
a fig leaf,
fig leaves on things.
Yeah. Mm. No, I think if there's more detail if you go read that interview. Spielberg actually says he now thinks of it and he realizes it comes with age. He now thinks of it as a film is a piece of history in its time and place. So you don't touch it again.
But
it's
like,
done.
It's not until sort of our era that you actually start realizing stuff like that. When we start going back and watching all these remakes that are coming out, it's when you start doing things like this, you start noticing this about film.
Yeah.
It's like at first it was a great idea to take Texas Chainsaw and redo it because when we first thought about it, we were like, well, the movie was shot terribly, it was grainy, it was horrible. Yeah, this film needs a revamp. And then you watch it and you go, that was everything I expected it to be. Why didn't it work? And it's not until you sit down and think about it that you'll actually figure that out.
Yeah.
But Widget talks about George Lucas and, you know, would have rather do the animation himself when he didn't need the actors. That's because he can't direct and he can't interact with people.
Mm. And you know, actually, I'm gonna have to
sorry, finish that sentence.
I feel like I continually have to defend him, and I don't want to defend him because I actually agree on the most part. But I will start by saying that Lucas can direct. All right, he's not very good now because let's face it, he hasn't made a film in 20 something years, and then he showed up and made three big budget films in a row. That if you come off cold anything, you're not going to be able to do it. We forget that Lucas had only made three films in his entire life. He'd only directed three films. And out of those three...
HTX 1136.
Yeah, out of those three, two of them are considered masterpieces.
Yeah.
Which are American Graffiti, which is a brilliant film with brilliant performances, and Star Wars. Mm. You know, he didn't direct Empire. He didn't direct Return of the Jedi. He didn't direct anything.
He wrote the story.
Mm. He didn't write it. He wrote the story. Lawrence Kasdan wrote Raiders. Lawrence Kasdan wrote the screenplay to Empire Strikes Back. You know, he had writers and other and directors come in and work on his stuff. He hadn't directed a film in 20-something years and then turns around and goes, I'm going to direct Phantom Menace.
Mm.
And immediately goes in cold after not directing anything for
plus
years.
Plus grappling with all that new technology.
New technology, and he was ill-equipped to deal with directing that film. He should have brought in somebody else to direct it, or done what he originally said he was going to do, which would have been the smart thing to do, which was direct Phantom Menace to set the tone like he did with the first Star Wars, and then bring in other directors to fix it.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
And we would have had Attack of the Clones be the empire of that series had he brought in a good director to take on the mantle and actually direct it. But to say a blanket, he's a terrible director, is really unfair to a man who actually did direct two monstrous runaway hits that were really good films. Mm. It's just, I don't think he's a good director now.
Mm.
I think that's the bigger issue, you know? I think he's a better producer than a director.
Yeah.
But I think he's got some wacky, weird ideas about cinema. And this is the problem, is that where everybody else is saying we should be preserving our history, Lucas looks at films as something that are a work in progress.
Yeah. Mm.
And I don't agree with his philosophy of a work in progress.
No, yeah. I agree.
You know? But that's a debate for a whole different time. But if you guys have not seen American Graffiti, anybody listening, if you have not seen American Graffiti, go out and rent it and watch it. This film is fantastic.
And do it before he decides to come back and add in some 3D animated people.
Like he did with THX-1138.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Oh, don't.
THX-1138 has been completely redone. Although, to its credit, I will say that the changes he made to THX actually do make a better film. THX, his director's cut of THX-1138 is actually not bad. It's actually really well done. It's very seamless, and it just expands the world. And I didn't actually mind that so much. I would prefer to have had the original version, but sure. It didn't hurt my soul, because THX-1138 is not one of my favorite films anyway. Mm. I think it's an interesting film.
Mm.
But to go in, if he touches American Graffiti, slap the boy. it's a film which
they
just
could be like. They could be like you know, Heritage Orders. Maybe, you know, they could do a thing like, you know,
we
like
need Heritage on films,
and they should say you can't touch that.
Yeah, I would love to see Heritage.
Bit
on
of
films.
MC Hammer.
Sweepy says, "I love American Graffiti."
That's where I win.
Can't touch that.
All right, let's move on. We're running late again, as always.
I'm sorry.
What are we up to? Oh! Plot details. Oh, gotta read you this. Remember about a year ago we said that...
Oh, God, fuck off.
Remember about a year ago they said that they had licensed the game Asteroids to be a film?
Yes.
There's a cream for that.
Which everybody thought was the most stupid thing in the world, because let's face it was a vector game where you shot asteroids, right? Well, apparently there has been movement on this. It says 2 Julys ago, actually. So it was
Red Robin 58.
2 years ago we talked about this. Well, now apparently the plot has come out and says that... the film is basically about a world that has been destroyed. So civilization has already been destroyed, and human civilization has been basically flung out into space, and they're living in colonies in an asteroid field. And then the aliens come in and want to attack them. And who's the director who's been approached for this?
The guy Michael that did Bay. Starship Troopers.
Roland Emmerich.
Oh.
What did he direct?
Independence Day, Godzilla, Day After Tomorrow. He destroys 2012. He destroys the world a lot.
I was going to say, shit blows up.
Yeah. He actually said that in an interview after 2012 that he wasn't going to make any more end-of-the-world movies. He said that he's finished with that now. And somebody said that he could technically do this because theoretically the world's already been blown up.
Yeah, he's just doing the after.
He should shock them and do a movie on the Big Bang.
Well, no, he's doing a movie on fucking
Shakespeare.
What's his name? Shakespeare next.
He's got
Which one?
His new film coming out is called Anonymous, and it's all about...
And it has, like, giant war scenes and stuff being exploded. And I'm like, dude, this isn't a fast step.
Yeah. Which,
It's oh a film.
God,
it's a,
I'm sorry. I will show you the trailer.
Yeah, it's a film. We actually talked about it several weeks ago. It's a film called Anonymous, and basically, it's a film playing up on that conspiracy that Shakespeare didn't actually write anything.
Oh, that stuff.
Yeah. So yeah. So anyway, it says here that Roland Emmerich is considering this film. We don't know any details beyond that, but yes, Asteroids looks like it is going to happen at this point,
Jesus.
Which is the most ridiculously weird thing I have ever heard.
I don't remember there being aliens in the Asteroids game, but maybe
Little UFOs come along and shoot at you. They go, They come through the asteroid field.
They've got to be piloted by something, Josh.
Yeah, there are UFOs in it. Go back and play Asteroids again. Okay. Werner Herzog. Our man. Werner Herzog proves that he is as mad as a snake.
I love this man. I love that title.
I love this man too. I know I spent 2 hours trying to get this video clip, and because Comedy Channel is so weird about it, I ended up not being able to get video, but I did get the audio at least, and I will let you listen to the audio. Basically, Werner Herzog is about to come out with a new documentary. And anybody who watches the Colbert Report, which I just love Stephen Colbert, Colbert interviewed him about his new documentary and approached the question to Werner Herzog about the fact that Werner Herzog seems to make stuff up in his documentaries, because Werner Herzog likes to make things up.
Is he the one that did the Loch Ness thing?
No, he's the one that did the one about the guy who lived with bears and then ended up getting mauled by the bear.
But I think he was in a Loch Ness thing that was on a couple of weeks ago on SBS.
Oh, was he? I don't know.
And then the whole thing, it was like a documentary being made of someone trying to track the Loch Ness monster, and then people get taken, and then the camera... I don't know
if it's this guy or not. Werner Herzog actually makes documentaries. His stuff is real, but then he kind of expands on it a little bit. And he explains why. Okay, so this is, I think... So here's a picture of Werner Herzog Ferrara. I think he's a lunatic.
I love him.
And have a listen to this.
Yeah. Are you making any of this stuff up? Because you've caught some flack for your documentaries because you sometimes make stuff up. Or you say intensify.
Yes.
And I do that every night, right into that lens over there. So I've made up some crazy stuff, and I don't care if they know what's what.
Well, in Cave of Forgotten Dreams, there's a postscript, and all of a sudden you see radioactive albino crocodiles in the film. I called the producer from when I was shooting, and I said, and he was in a pet store in Vancouver and had just bought a cage for a hamster. And he said, I just bought a cage of a hamster. And I said, I'm filming albino mutant crocodiles, radioactive crocodiles. And I hear this clatter. He dropped the cage and said, you are shooting what? And I said, I'm shooting albino crocodiles, and they will be in the film. So it's a wild postscript, a wild science fiction sort of fantasy at the end. And I want the audience with me in wild fantasies, in something that
fucking illuminates
them.
This guy is a lunatic. I love him.
If I were only fact-based, you see... The book of books in literature then would be the Manhattan phone directory. 4 million entries, everything correct. But it dusts out of my ears, and I do not know, do they dream at night? Does Mr. Jonathan Smith cry in his pillow at night?
Oh, you're just such a visionary. It's amazing.
We do not know anything when we check all the correct entries in the phone directory. I'm not this kind of a filmmaker.
Like, you know what, man? The whole thing is, we know now that the guy doesn't make documentaries. He makes, like, documentaries plus. And you know what? Keep making them, man, because I think, like, the whole thing is, the dude has a sense of humor that just leads me to believe that he knows he's fucking people over.
Now, I got to also say that Werner Herzog is a lunatic. We know this. We talked about it on this show once before about his film school, where he wanted to create a film school, and subjects included things like lockpicking and how to fake permits.
Right? Yeah.
And I actually, while I was looking for this video, I have to share this with you very quickly. While I was looking for this video, I actually came across another video, which I was so close to putting in the show, where he was doing an interview about a previous film, and they were on the roof of a Los Angeles building, and he's starting to talk, and then you hear a shot fire out, and he gets shot in the abdomen while they're doing the interview. Somebody shot him with an air rifle, right? Yeah. And so they move off the roof, and they go inside, and they drive to a different location, and the interviewer saying, should we take you to the hospital? He goes, no, it's okay. And so they get to another place, and they're sitting down to talk again, and he's saying, the interviewer says, an amazing person, and even in this interview you just got shot while we were doing this interview, and Werner Herzog goes, an insignificant bullet. And then they got him to actually show his abdomen, and he's bleeding. I mean, oh, he's actually sitting there bleeding from his abdomen. He goes, it's an insignificant bullet. It's okay.
Don't forget to explain.
This is why I love him, because like he does things like these bizarre, you know, sort of things that we just saw and his interviews and stuff like this, and these things that he tacks onto the end of his film, or his wonderful effort in Bad Lieutenant, which we both absolutely love. But it's like there's something about him that just makes me go, you're taking the piss, and I love you for it, because he goes out and he does these bizarre things, but then he does something really grounded, like the episode of Boondocks he does, where he is playing an interviewer interviewing the fake characters in this TV series about Obama, and everything is relevant because it's a concept. The whole thing is a sort of a speech on how the black public reacted to Obama in this ridiculous way that just made no sense in 90% of the time. And Werner Herzog is actually the voice of the actor, and he's actually in the episode. And it's like, you look at that and you go, I don't know, man, you're just a little bit too smart to just be fucking around with this without any knowledge of what's going on. I reckon he's just mad as a hatter, and if so, I respect anyone that can make it.
I think he's nuts. I love him. I think he's absolutely nuts. And if you ever go back and watch one of his early films called Fitzcarraldo, where they actually drag the boat across the jungle, yeah. And you sit there and go, they actually lived that experience. It's like, yes, it's a fictional film and everything else, but they actually did drag a boat across the Amazon, you know? And he kind of did drive his star Klaus Kinski kind of insane doing all of this. And so it's all very real. When you're watching this film, you're going, these people are nuts. Everybody here is nuts, you know?
Look at this. Widget says, you know, you talk about radioactive albino crocodiles. Widget goes, sharks with friggin' lasers.
Friggin' lasers. Anyway, let's move on. A couple quick ones. Dwayne Johnson could be joining the cast of the new G.I. Joe sequel. Might actually make it worth watching. Yeah. Another one was that Sacha Baron Cohen's new film has finally kind of been revealed a little bit. Mm. And I had to share this with you because I actually really want to see this film, I've decided. Because when you read the plot, and I'll see if I can find this plot for you. It's on Slash Film. And first of all, I will I have a picture that we'll also have a look at here in a second. But basically, it says here that once again, directed by Larry Charles, who directed the Borat film. It's not a documentary this time; it is just a film. Yeah. But it says that Baron Cohen plays a ruthless dictator who heads to the U.S. for a meeting at the United Nations and finds that his number two has replaced him with an unsuspecting sheepherder lookalike. As the dictator wanders the city, he meets the owner of an organic food store. She turns around his dictatorial thinking, and there's a little romance in it as well. It's a remake of Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator. Yeah. But I think there's one moment here where it says, where is it? In this article, it actually described one thing in it, and that made me laugh. I can't find it, but let me show you the picture really quickly. This is the dictator. Are you ready?
Yeah, I saw that.
Yes.
You can find this picture on the link in our show notes for the audio listeners. Here it is. Cohen will star alongside, and I just love this. This is from Slash Film. It says, Cohen will star alongside Ben Kingsley, Jason Mantzoukas, and Anna Faris in the heroic story of a dictator who risked his life to ensure that democracy would never come to the country that he so lovingly oppressed. It is inspired by the best-selling novel Zabiba and the King by Saddam Hussein.
Oh, wow.
Is that a real novel?
I don't know. anyway, so there you go. And it's loosely, as I say, it's a loose remake of Charlie Chaplin's film The Great Dictator as well, which was loosely based on Hitler. So go figure.
Well, not so loosely.
Okay, and finally this crap. We got to get this out. Shake it off, Josh. I know.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
You got to do it.
I'm desensitized now. I just don't give a
shit. All
I
can say is it's almost over. Okay, it's almost over, and people are going, what the hell are we talking about? The reason why I'm showing this, though, is because I just want you to watch Jacob in this clip, because I don't know about you, but when I get wedding invites, this is how I act.
What do you mean it's almost over? This is part one of two.
Yeah, but that's it. Then it's over. This is the last book. It's finished. This is, of course,
two motherfucking parts.
The Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn. Part one.
Breaking Wind.
And it does actually show them very briefly. There's 1 second in this trailer, if you look really fast, where they're having sex and pulling down the whole bed. You know how he's supposed to break her back or something while they have sex? So this could be good. All right, here you go. Jacob, this is how I would act if I got a wedding invite.
measure of time with you would be long enough. But we'll start with forever.
That she's barely showing. They couldn't even put a decent fat belly
no,
on
that's,
her.
No, that's a good bit of wind. I'm sorry. I thought he wind. Couldn't have sex with her if she wasn't a vampire because he'd want to eat her midway through the act.
Well, not just that. Apparently he's so strong that in the book, when he actually does have sex with her, and I haven't read it, so Twilight fans, write to me and tell me, but apparently when she does have sex with him, he literally breaks her back. And so he has to turn her into a vampire to save her life.
Or spinal surgery, one or the other. That's... stupid.
And apparently, the part that we really want to see is apparently when she goes into labor. I had trouble getting this out. Apparently, in the book, and we just are dying to see this. Apparently, he has to chew the baby out.
Yeah, Red Robin, can you just tell us how the baby's delivered, please? She's read the book.
Okay, apparently, he has to chew the baby out or something.
I've not heard of a knife.
Anyway, in answer to your question, Dave, no, you're right. That isn't how I usually I would deal
no,
with somebody
I
giving me
a
wedding invite, but I cannot also turn into a wolf.
No,
so
that's true. Look, he knew he was getting cross and he was going to rip his shirt when he turned to the big dog. He's on a fixed income. That's not a big town. He has to take the shirt off, otherwise he's got to go back to Walmart and buy more shirts.
No, I get what you're trying to say, but isn't he supposed to be angry?
Yeah.
No one thinks about stuff like that when you're angry.
Depends on how many shirts you've gone through.
That's a good line. I like that.
And I love the fact that the wedding invite was conveniently laminated in case it was red in the rain.
Yeah, and I thought, see, they could have cried on it, big tears, and have it streamed
like
mascara.
Well, that's what I imagine the emo-ness was actually what it was covering.
Emo-ness?
Against.
Is that a new word, like bootylicious?
Emo-ness. It's like emo's, but ness. Yes. I don't know. Anyway, moving right along.
All right, it's that time of the week, everybody. Get out your lists. It is time for our list of five. Now, I've tried to explain this a little bit.
I'm gonna have to get it.
And I've said to celebrate the release of Super 8, our list is to deliver a list of great films from that era that the film is set in. So the 77 to 86 kind of period. So our list is five great films from the Super 8 era. Not now that the film is being made, but the era that it is set in and that era that it is paying homage to. Now, it's a very loose list. We've all interpreted this in very different ways. And I'm not real keen on my list because I think it's actually pretty... my list is pretty predictable. All right? So we'll just go through this really quickly.
Can I just do a caveat?
A caveat, sure.
Well, I cocked mine up because I stay purely within the time period as opposed to trying to think kid-based movies within that time
That's
period.
That's fine.
Okay.
We didn't say anything about kids here. We're going to cut through this very quickly, though, because we are running long and we do have to get the little geek in at the end. So let's go through this very, very quickly. I'm going to start us off and I'm going to say my number five. I took this list as being five films that if you haven't seen them, these are films you have to have seen from that era. Okay?
Right.
Simple as that. And my number five is The Last Starfighter, which came in 1984. And it's basically follows the right formula. It's the outsider kid who gets made into a hero, blah, blah, blah. It is of note that it was the first film that had 100% CG spaceships and space battles. Unfortunately, it looks like a 1988 computer game. But don't hold that against it. It was trying something different. But the film itself is actually a lot of fun. Josh, you're number five.
Okay, well, my list is based on the concept that it was films around and about that time. And my caveat was basically to try and get films that either had heart or had character building to the point where you fell in love with the members of the cast, or at least were worried about their safety.
Cool.
So that's
all right,
kind
so
of
that's
where
yours.
I was going.
All right.
Okay, so number five on my list was Halloween. Simply because, look, it's a great movie, it's suspenseful, it's horrific, all that sort of stuff, but it's got enough storyline and character building that the characters that are supposed to terrify you and the characters you're supposed to would like,
you care like, about them. Yeah.
And the ones that you don't care about get killed absolutely morally and bloodily.
No,
just how I would
bastard.
Like real life to happen.
Cool.
Going on.
Number five, Katrina.
Airplane, which was flying high. Not
I love that movie.
Shit, yes.
As you can see, listeners, I've gone slightly off from Josh's caveat. I cared about that inflatable captain.
There you go. All right. I love Flying High in Australia, Airplane in America. And it is still to this day the best spoof film made.
The queuing up to slap the hysterical woman.
Yes. Or, excuse me, stewardess, I speak jive. My number four is Gremlins. This fit perfectly. And I actually kind of think that Super 8 is the godchild of Gremlins and my number one. So we'll come back to that later. It's kind of like this the hybrid film. Gremlins, I think, perfectly fit this in this fact that it had one had a perfect family. The other one had the damaged one where the father was found in the chimney. You had the scares, but not the terrifying. You had the excitement. You had the humor. It was just a lot of fun. So I really liked Gremlins, and I recommend it. Josh?
My number four is a film. Don't hate me for this, because if anybody would, you might.
All right, Josh's number four is a film, so let's move on.
Number four is actually just a really fond memory I have as a kid.
Yep.
It was one of those films that we recorded off TV, and I just watched ad nauseum, and it is Batteries Not Included.
I love Batteries Not Included.
Which was an executive produced by Steven Spielberg, and I just think the little metal tin cans are so fucking cute.
I loved Batteries Not Included. Actually, was very close to my heart at that time. And it also, I love the fact that they actually did a reworking of the Warner Brothers cartoon music. That dun 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 dun.
Yeah,
dun.
Oh,
I love the fact that they worked that into that film. Just fantastic.
That was just the Acme stuff when you were building.
Yeah. Not happy birthday.
Don't forget the gravy. Okay, my number four, The Big Red One, 1980. Mark Hamill, Lee Marvin, World War II thing.
Own the DVD downstairs.
Well, there you go.
Great film. John Milius film. Fantastic stuff.
Powerful scene was when they opened the oven door in the concentration camp, and then they found one lone Nazi, and the guy that opened the oven door took all his rage out on that particular officer.
Good film. All right, my number three is Poltergeist, written by Spielberg, directed by Tobe Hooper, debatable. a film that really encaptured the entire Spielberg feeling that a lot of Super 8s actually got going for it as well. That whole small town suburbia, the whole strange things happening to normal people. Great performances. I know it's not one of Josh's favorite films, but I have a very soft spot for Poltergeist. I think it really is a great time capsule for that period of time. Mm-hmm. Your number three.
My number three is Jaws.
Oh, great film. Although,
Jaws predates is 75.
The era a little bit, but that's all right.
It's the wrong era. I looked it up. It's 75.
But I said we can play loose and fast with the dates. That's all right.
Oh, God, I'm bloody researched.
Yeah, no, I actually, didn't we originally say 75?
And then we changed it to 77 because it
was... Oh, 80. Jesus Christ. If you're going to change the rules, I'm going to get this shit wrong. Yes, 75, Jaws. I don't give a shit.
Now, he really means Jaws 4.
But I'm going to give him Jaws because I think Jaws is a masterpiece and one of my favorite films of all time. So.
Oh, should I put that down first and I crossed
you
it
can
out?
Have it as a, can have it. You can have it as an honorary mention.
Moving Thank right you. Along, next one.
Corvette Summer. 1978.
Oh, good Lord.
I'm just being wild.
Now, Corvette Summer, Mark Hamill
and
in the lead.
And the chick that was the secretary out of Ghostbusters.
Was this one directed by Ron Howard? Was this his first film? I think it might be.
I'm beyond that. I don't know that.
I think Ron Howard may have directed Corvette Summer.
But the girl that played was the girl that was the secretary in Ghostbusters.
Annie Potts.
Yeah. I'm just going to caveat by saying if you think her one is bad, like that one, oh man, my number one is going to spin.
Oh, wow.
You.
Okay. Let's keep on going. My number
Neither
two.
Neither of you have seen this film. So.
My number two was my number one, but I demoted it because I felt that you'll see why. My number two is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Because I think it was actually going to be my number one, but I've demoted it to number two. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is the spiritual cousin of Super 8, I think. Here is a film. We have a family in turmoil and eventually a broken family. We have all the Spielberg moments of that whole learning wonder. And it's just an amazing film. And Close Encounters is one of those films that a lot of people today of the modern generation just haven't seen.
Yeah.
And I don't know why you haven't seen it. Go see it.
It's really helpful. And it's the only film I've ever seen in my life that involves sculpture of mashed potato.
Mm, absolutely.
Awesome.
Great film. You're number two.
All right, my number two is Big Trouble in Little Chinatown.
I love that movie.
Exactly. Look, I mean, it gets that
Kim
reaction
Cattrall
out of geeks.
Kim Cattrall acted and didn't take a tits out.
Yep. Look, I mean, it's the only action film that I've watched, and it's just you have the most incompetent hero you could possibly have, and you just adore him. Because it's just the whole time, you're just thinking, if I was in that situation, that's exactly what I'd do. If I saw a dude, a dude that could shoot lightning in his hands, I'd probably want to take off.
two chicks with big green eyes.
Yeah. No, it was
well
great.
Well done.
Or two chicks with really good green contact lenses.
Pretty much. Only I have that level of penetrating green eyes.
Okay, you're number two.
Blade Runner, 1982.
Great film. One of my all-time faves.
Nothing more to say.
Now, which version of Blade Runner do you like? Are you a director's cut, final cut, or original cut?
Final
person?
Cut.
Well, I can't. I'll tell you what I don't like. I don't like the Harrison Ford voiceover trying to be the tired film noir cop.
So you're a director's cut person. Mm. Yeah. I actually have to say that the final cut and director's cut are virtually identical anyway in cut. That's just the final cut. Fix some. And this is the one case where I'm going to say I didn't mind the fixes.
Oh, damn
right.
Because it was a situation where they tried to be as absolutely accurate to the film as they could be, but they had some obvious things that needed to be fixed.
Yeah. Mm.
And these are things that they wanted to fix at the time, but the studio, they were so over budget, so over time, the studio forced it into release, and then they made all those manipulations by adding voiceovers, and they butchered it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that it was a chance for Ridley Scott to go back and actually finish the film.
Yeah.
You know?
And I also have to say, I adore film noir. I love Humphrey Bogart movies, and I've read, you know, Raymond Chandler stuff. And I have to say that in terms of the purity of, like, you know, the racist cop and then the motifs that the Philip K. Dick story brings out is just really a special movie. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's a fantastic film. All right, my number one is already been said in the chat room about 17,000 times by my son, so I will just say it, and that is, of course, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Now, I will actually say that E.T. was actually off my list. I took it off the table, and I actually put it back on at the 0 hour. I took it off because it's too obvious.
Mm.
But I had to put it back on because between Gremlins, Close Encounters, Poltergeist, and E.T. is what spawned Super 8. Mm. I mean, you look at that collection of films, in particular Close Encounters and E.T.
Yeah.
You look at those two films and you go, those are the spiritual parents of Super 8 in every way. E.T. is a film that is, over the years, has kind of fallen away. People sit there and go, oh, it's a kid's film, it's a kid's film. You got to remember, in 1982, this was not a kid's film. In 1982, this was a film that everyone in the world went to see.
Pretty much,
This was the biggest box office hit of all time until Titanic came out. Mm. It knocked Star Wars off its perch. This film was enormously successful, and for good reason. This film is a masterpiece. Mm. It is so well put together. It is so well acted. The alien was so believable, even though he was a rubber puppet.
Yeah, yeah.
That you just sat there and just bought
you
everything
about it.
You
cried your guts out.
Absolutely. And if you only... didn't I remember seeing this film, I was 14, and they said, you're going to cry. Everybody cries in this movie. I said, I don't cry in movies. Even I cried in this movie. If you don't cry the first time you see E.T., you have no soul. It's as simple as that.
That's
you know?
Right. You're like the chick out of Twilight. Well done, James from Melbourne, and Widget quoting lines from Blade Runner.
Yep.
Nicely done.
I'm actually going to say, you say your last one, because I'm actually building up some anticipation.
Okay, okay.
One.
Skip over. You're number
trust
one.
Trust me, it's worth it.
Well, this is going to be obvious, but I was very torn between this being my number one and number two. So pretty well, I think they're almost on the same level. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, yeah. Great
1981.
Film. Yeah.
Okay,
Josh, hit us.
Right. Well, look, when you first gave me the concept of what you wanted and you wanted to sell what was that generation and that era and really consolidating films that consolidated that period of time, right? There's one particular film that has everything that you didn't want to remember about that era. Everything that when you look back, you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, no way, we did not look like that. And that's fucking Phantasm, man. Phantasm,
oh, Phantasm
by Don Corleone, otherwise known as, what is it, Never Dead?
Not Don Corleone, that's the character from Govo. Don Castellaneta.
Yeah.
I don't know Phantasm.
In Australia, it actually goes by a different name. It was actually called The Never Dead.
The Never Dead. And it is the most messed up film you will ever see in your life.
You might remember the catchphrase on the poster. It said, if this one doesn't scare you, you're already dead.
It's horrible.
Are they fast moving or slow moving?
Oh, neither. No, dude. It's a bizarre collection of concepts. It's a guy who, I don't know, what did he eat, souls or eat people?
To this day, I have no idea what the film
is
about.
There's no general explanation for what he is. He's called the Tall
all,
Man.
All that we really remember about that film is he's got those silver balls with the blades at the front.
Yeah, exactly. These bizarre-looking silver balls that there is no mention until three-quarters of the way through the film, and then after that, no further mention, where he just lifts up a ball and goes like this, and it just flies forward and drills through the head of someone. Never explained... Never followed up on. The second and third and fourth films go into it.
Well, there's more.
Depth.
They made more.
Oh, it's a whole series of them.
Four.
Yeah, it's a whole series of them.
But yeah, you just watch this film and it just has all those collections of things about that era, like words like jive, things like saying he's one tough mother, all those fucking lines that we left in the 70s and just left to die. They're all in one collaborated film. It is fantastic.
Yeah. So do you think it's on the same creative level as that Eddie Murphy one where he was Dracula?
This is a whole different kind of fish, because at least that has a plot. This doesn't.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
And this actually doesn't have a plot.
And what's really interesting is that this is the filmmaker who went on to actually direct a film that I absolutely adore. He went on to direct Bubba Hotep, which is just fantastic.
I love Bubba Hotep.
So,
spelling for H.C. Widget, it's P-H-A-N-T-A-S-M.
Yeah, James from Melbourne's already put it in the chat room.
There you go.
Phantasm. Yeah. Not to be mistaken with the John Holmes film called Phantasm that came out in the late 70s.
Or Phantasmagoria, which is a game which is a lot more of the same, but a little bit more storyline, and I do
because
say
it's got more syllables.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this
good,
film...
Good choice.
This film, I got to the end of that, and I was like, what the fuck did I just watch? I was like, that wasn't a movie?
Josh uses the list of the five as a way to purge himself.
He does. He's like shedding his skin.
And it's also great, because you get out of all these films that you can share with people and they can sit down and go, wow, that really was a
is sorry, James Melbourne says that the John Holmes one is an 80s retro. I thought it was actually late 70s, but anyway, that's a whole different issue.
Oh, come on, let's not debate times on porn. We're already over
that's
time.
Not actually porn, but anyway, that's a whole different issue. Okay, let's move on. That's our list. Thank you very much. We've got to move on because we've got the Little Geek coming in just a few minutes. If you agree or disagree with anything that we've had to say this week or our reviews or any of the news, or you have something you just want to get off your chest, send your feedback to feedback.
Or if you liked Phantasm.
Or if you liked Phantasm.
We'll get
absolutely.
You the number of a counselor.
Feedback at filmactually.com is our email address. Or drop us a voicemail. Send me number.
Sorry, I couldn't help that one.
And he's talking about Shutter Island.
Sydney number 0280113167, or you can use the Skype ID Geek Actually. Get our merchandise, join our fan page, follow us on Twitter, follow our I don't know, everything. Everything you want to do, go to geekactually.com. There's a follow us button right on the side. I'm looking at it right now. I can see it on the webpage. Click on that, you'll find all our links to everything that we do. Or you can watch us record this show live every Saturday starting now. We start the record day at around 12 p.m. ish. We record Geek Actually first, followed by Film Actually. So the start time on Film Actually is fluid, to say the least.
It's very fluid. I had a big cup of tea before.
It's usually about 1:30, 1:40 is the start time, but it can be later. But we are doing another show, so if you come in earlier, you'll see the end of the other show.
Delta's got an issue.
What?
About you didn't read out a feedback.
Yeah, well, that's why you put it in an email and send it to us.
Yeah, no,
she
didn't, no.
She didn't read it out, she said.
No,
that's what I'm saying.
Delta's a guy, by the way.
Delta,
I did see your feedback, but we had such a full show that I just had to hold off for it. We may do it next week, okay?
Yeah, but then that's what I'm saying.
Sorry,
Delta, write in an email like we actually already explained in the show and send an email about the fact that your email wasn't read out, and then we'll read it out next week.
There you go. Hey, feedback.
I did, LOL.
No, he's saying write another one saying complaining that you didn't get your feedback.
I think.
Okay. That's right. Like that Monty Python thing. If you're in the first class, put your peg on the high hook, and then if your brother's in the other class, put the peg underneath. And if you haven't had your feedback read out, put on the email, and then put the email predated to your previous email. Sorry.
Love it. That's
can I finish
awesome.
The show now?
No.
Okay,
what?
Good. All right.
What show?
Look, also, please be aware that we don't always read all feedback on the show. Keep sending it. We read everything. Not everything gets read on the show.
We love you, Delta.
Delta, as you know by your show links in Geek Actually, everything was loose today. All right, Charlie and Brad are back. You can check them out at reboundradio.com. He was in the house before. They were the former hosts of the, movie fanhouse.com. And now they are with reboundradio.com is their new site. Their new podcast is coming soon. Weekendronin.com is the home of the Real Junkies, R-E-E-L Junkies. They are our good friends, and they like to drink tequila while they review films. Find them on iTunes or go to their website. They are fantastic. Rachel over at the Funky Film Show, catch her reviews every Thursday on Radio Fremantle 107.9 FM or RadioFremantle.com if you miss it live. And she's so funny because she said, I can't believe you still plug me. So, and it's really badly worded what I just said there.
I was going to say.
All right. Josh, what's your site?
All right. I got this ready. Radio Seeds, a gaming website. Go on, check it out. We go out live at 8 p.m. on Tuesday night. Goodbye.
Wow. Okay.
Go. I'm going to get faster eventually. I'll just be like, bleh.
All right. Now, you also want to give out one quick special plug to Josh Spencer over at attackninja.blogspot.com. He is our artist who did our caricatures on our site, and he doesn't get enough credit. He is fantastic.
And the mugs.
And the mugs and everything else. He is a fantastic artist. Go check out his other work at attackninja.blogspot.com. Okay. I think that's it. Now, normally we go out with a piece of music from the score of the film that we just watched. However.
That was amazing. A collection of words somehow fitted together without you slipping your tongue.
I know, that's pretty good, wasn't it? However, the Super 8 soundtrack doesn't come out until July 28th. Fuck them. So I don't have it. So I thought in that case...
I don't think fuck them's in the Gregorian calendar.
Yeah, no.
Considering that we don't have the score for Super 8, I decided that we would finish the show today with a piece of the end titles track from John Williams' masterpiece score for E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Because it's so funny, we all think of E.T., we forget how good that score was. I mean, we are talking about an astronomical award-winning score that you just don't think of anymore because you go, oh, it's E.T. phone home and all that. But when you actually listen to the music, it is a truly powerful album. So we'll go out with a little piece of this because it really is the music of the era. This is the music that defined an era. When we do have the Super 8 score, we might play a little bit of that later in a couple of weeks. But for the moment, that's all we got. Have you got anything else you want to plug, Katrina?
No. I love geek, actually. Keep listening, and that's all I've got to say at the moment.
Thank you. Josh, anything else?
No.
In that case, say goodnight, Gracie.
What, Gracie?
Goodnight, Gracie.
God.
We'll explain it to you later. Well, you're too young.
You're too young, sorry.
All right. Fucking old people.
All right, let me drop that out of sight for the moment, and we're going to say, in that case, if nobody else has anything else to say, I'm going to say
bye.
Thank you, same chat time. Room. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, everybody. Go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies, and my board has crashed. Typical. It crashes at the end.
Well, I can't remember the theme music for E.T., but we can
goodbye
do
now.
Oh, we're going to do the music. We're going to do the music anyway. We've got sound. We just don't have video. Okay. Goodbye, everybody. Bye. Have a good night. And I'm now joined by Nicholas, the little geek McVeigh. How are you, Nicholas?
I'm great.
Now, we thought we needed to get you on because whenever we do films that are kind of family related, we like to get Nicholas in to get his opinion. Now, this film is an interesting one because normally a film like this, parents get all freaked out by modern parents, that is.
Because it has swearing. It
has swearing. It's got violence and, you know, and so forth. And I don't know. We've had this long debate on the show already about how, you know, kids today don't seem to have the freedoms that they had back then and so forth. And so there's going to be a lot of parents who go, oh, this film might be too violent for my kids, or it might be too scary for my kids, or it might be too this for my kids, you know, whatever. So we thought, well, damn it, I got you to see it. You're 12 years old. I would have been 12 and seen this sort of film. So I want to know, from your opinion, what did you think of Super 8?
I absolutely loved it.
Yay!
I mean, I think it's probably the best film I have ever seen.
Ever seen? Wow, that's going. I'm going to show you E.T.
No, just kidding. No, I've seen E.T. No, yeah. I mean, I forgot. I worded it. I mean, the year.
Of the year. Okay. Yeah. No, I think that's a fair statement. So you weren't too scared?
No.
It didn't scar you for life?
No.
So what was it about this film that particularly spoke to you?
I like how it was kind of like the 70s. I like E.T.
Yeah.
So I kind of like how it was like a bit like that.
Yep.
And I also watched Cross Encounters
yep.
and stuff. So I thought it was really cool like that.
So you like that era?
Yeah, I like the era.
Did you relate to the kids?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Yeah? I thought you might relate to Charles. In particular. I had this funny feeling that you would relate to Charles.
But not as bossy as him.
No, but the whole idea of the wanting to make movies and all that sort of stuff, I thought that just, it feels like a Nicholas thing, going out there and making your films. So, what did you think of the relationship between Joel and Elle, about the lead boy and girl?
That was
wasn't too mushy for you or anything like that? You didn't sit there going, I don't want the romance. No?
No.
So that spoke to you? You felt that? Yeah. All right, so we try and do stuff without spoilers in this section, so we don't want to give too many spoilers, but did you find the film scary?
It's like Gremlins.
It's like Gremlins, yeah?
Yeah, it's like, it scared me. It scared me, but it didn't, like, you know, completely, like, as you said before, it didn't scar me for life.
Did you have nightmares at all?
No.
No, so there you go. So you found it exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's exactly what this film is supposed to do. It's supposed to give you that excitement level, but it's not supposed to terrify you, I think, is what you want to do. Okay, what else about this film? What did you think of their, this is minor spoilers, in the end credits you finally get to see the movie that they were actually making.
I thought it was so funny. So
stick through the credits. We won't say what actually happens in it, but what did you think of that?
I thought it was so funny. It's okay if I could just say one thing.
Okay, one thing.
I really like the part where, like, there's a cure for the zombie thing. And he says, how much did you make? I only made this one syringe.
I love the fact that it's so tackly made as well. I guess it's the Super 8 movie, so it doesn't really matter. But I love the fact that it's so tackly made that when he actually goes to inject that syringe, it's empty. You know, it's all those little technical things. I actually asked J.J. Abrams in the roundtable discussion whether he directed the Super 8 film at the end or whether some second unit handled it. He goes, no, he directed and he shot it. He said it was actually the most fun of the entire film was to actually shoot that Super 8 movie. And he said it was a lot of fun. And Sweet Pea in our chat room is now saying definitely going tomorrow. Go see this movie. It is well worth having a look at. Okay, scary in a good way, says H.C. Widget. And H.E. Widget also says, I need to see this one. And now, the real question from James from Melbourne says, did you have the same experience that I had that was so important to me? Now, what does that mean? Okay, James from Melbourne has said, what did you think of the dad?
That was pretty cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He didn't, because he wasn't really paying much attention to his kids, or his kid.
Yeah.
So did you believe that relationship? Or?
Yeah, I believed that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And were you mad at the father at all?
Parts of it, yeah.
Parts of it, yeah. Yeah? Okay, what else we got from the chat room? Any else? Okay, this is minor spoilers. Let's not actually spoil what it is or anything, but Sweet Pea wants to know, what did you think of the monster?
He was pretty cool.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
I like this. I won't say who he does it to, but one of the shots, the monster bashes some guy's head in with his head. Like, he just goes...
Poof. Oh, that's right. That's right. I remember that. Yeah. That was pretty cool.
He just hits his head at the guy, and then he dies.
Now, James wants to know, did you feel the same way I did when I walked out of E.T.? Well, that's kind of an open-ended question, because he needs to know how you felt when you walked out of E.T. Are you reliving my experiences? James! Okay, on that note, we'll probably wrap this up. So, I think the bottom line is, the bottom question here is, would you recommend this to your friends?
I already have. I actually recommended it to so many different friends.
Better knowing your friends the way you do, what do you think their parents would think about this film?
I'm not sure. Maybe they might go see it. Like, they sometimes watch M-rated films.
Yep.
But, yeah, I don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, look, I'm going to say this out there to the parents of the world out there and say that this film won't scar your children. It is a good film. It's a good, exciting film. And it's a film that you'll want to see with your kids. So go out and enjoy yourselves. Go out and have some fun. You know, it's ridiculous worrying about all this stuff all the time. And just go, it's a film. It's a movie.
It's a film.
Yes, they will be scared. know the age bracket and know your kids. Not all 12-year-olds are going to be able to take this film, but if you think your 12-year-old is mature enough to be able to watch something like E.T. or Gremlins, then by all means, this film is fine, and it's a lot of fun for them.
Just something to add. This is not about Super 8 or anything.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite shows, which is really badly made, has actually ended, so I'm kind of sad.
Which one, sorry?
The House of Anubis. If anyone's seen that on Nickelodeon, it actually finally ended today.
This is a series I can't stand, but Nicholas loves.
I know it's bad. It's like you in Smallville.
I guess we're all allowed our guilty pleasures. It's a Nickelodeon.
Yeah, show. It's the series ended.
The series ended.
Yes.
Finished. No more seasons.
No.
Yay! Thank God. I can't believe they actually finished the series. I thought it was actually being successful. Anyway, that's a whole different story. Sweet Pea says, love Smallville.
I loved it too.
So, all right. So then we're going to wrap this up because this show has been going very long.
Oh, could I just talk about new project?
One quick one. What is your project and where can people find you?
You can find me at youtube.com/ Nicki McVeigh.
Yep.
I'm working on a new one, which is a short. It's a Lego Pirates of the Caribbean short. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be like a Traveler's Tales game.
Yep.
So, like, when, like, a bad guy gets hit, he turns into pieces.
Cool.
And there's lots of kind of humor in it.
Fantastic. So people should look out for this on your channel. So everybody should go subscribe to Nicholas's channel.
Yeah, if you have a YouTube, please.
If you have a YouTube account, go subscribe to Nicholas's channel. You can find it at youtube.com/ Nicki McVeigh, NickyMcVay. And you'll be getting that film as soon as it's available then once it's out. So, good. Cool. All right. Is that it?
Yep.
We're done?
Yep.
All right. Thank you very much, Nicholas. And everybody have a good week.
End of line.
You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed. No memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.